You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning. Good morning to everyone here. Welcome to Brookings. I'm very happy that you could join us here, both those of you in the room and also people who are watching online. It's nice to see some familiar faces here, but for those of you who don't know me, my name is Stephanie Aronson, and I'm the Vice President and Director of the Economic Studies Program here at Brookings. And I'm truly delighted to join you here for this event on automation, labor market institutions, and the middle class, organized by our Future of the Middle Class initiative. For those of you who don't know, I'm actually a labor economist myself, and so I would find any conference on the topic of labor markets and automation interesting. But I'm particularly excited about this conference, which aims to move us beyond the typical efforts to characterize the role of automation in labor markets and actually move us toward trying to make that research useful for policymakers, for firms, and for workers and their advocates who have the responsibility now of re-envisioning our labor market policies and institutions to ensure that they are up to the task of providing safety, stability, and security in an economy that in recent years has been transformed by technology. And the time for doing this has never been more urgent. In the United States, we are all too aware of the challenges that have beset the middle class in recent decades, including stagnant wages, rising prices for housing and education, such that for many workers, their ability to reach and remain in the middle class has never been more tenuous. Recognizing the importance of the challenges facing the middle class for both their own well-being and for our polity, the president of the Brookings Institution, John Allen, made the future of the middle class one of his first presidential research priorities. And given the strong ties between labor market outcomes and economic security more generally, it's not surprising that the initiative, under the leadership of Richard Reeves, has chosen as one of its first topics the issue of automation and work. So this conference could not be on a more important topic, and it could not come at a better time. Now, before we get on to the real meat of the program, I do want to thank a few people. Richard Reeves, the aforementioned director of the Future of the Middle Class Initiative, for his leadership. Marcus Casey, Rubenstein Fellow in the Economic Studies Program, for his efforts in organizing this conference and our other streams of work related to automation and the middle class. Hannah Vandry and Sara Nizau, also of the Future of the Middle Class Initiative, without whose efforts the conference would not have been possible, and Anna Dawson, our expert events coordinator. I also want to thank IBM for their support of the Future of the Middle Class Initiative. And with that, I'm happy to turn the podium over to James Besson from Boston University, who's going to get the real program started with his presentation, Automation, a Guide for Policymakers.
Great, thank you. Thank you for having me. So we hear a lot about artificial intelligence in the news. Maybe I should do this thing. I'll just stay near the microphone. These systems are able to beat humans at many complicated games. They're also able to perform better than humans on specific tasks, so they can identify some lesions on x-rays better than the average radiologist. They can drive cars, kind of. They can identify documents in legal discovery proceedings, in some cases better than humans. Does this mean that we're about to see a lot of unemployment of radiologists? A famous computer scientist in Toronto told medical schools to stop training radiologists because the software was going to make them obsolete in just a few years. He said that a few years ago, I'll point out. Are we going to lose our millions of truck drivers and taxi drivers, lawyers and paralegals? There was a famous study a number of years ago now by Frey and Osborne, which claimed that 47% of jobs will be automatable in the near future, in the near 10 or 20 years. And that study spawned a whole line of research. So we have, according to a few years ago, Technology Review, the MIT publication, put together a list of studies predicting massive job losses, some of them going into the billions, some of them more modest. But there is this, you know, overwhelming body of research of predictions serious consequences. And we know, economists have studied what happens at mass layoffs. And when we have these dire economic events like mass layoffs, where a firm closes down or lays off most of its workforce or a substantial part of its workforce, not only do people lose their jobs at that time and enter unemployment, but they have long-term earning losses, deteriorating health, lower consumption. So there are real significant burdens to these kinds of things. So what is the challenge for policy? Some people argue that we have this impending mass unemployment, and the answer is something like a universal basic income. But what is actually happening? Are these predictions real? And what does the actual evidence point to in terms of policy? So I'm going to talk about first the background of how we think about automation. In fact, I think many people are very confused about what automation is and how it works, and there's evidence about that. And then I'm going to report on a study that I did with some Dutch colleagues that looks at what the actual burden is on workers at firms that automate. To get to the punchline, I'm going to argue that the real policy challenge today is not impending mass unemployment. There is a very disruptive change coming, and there are many people who will lose jobs, but there will also be jobs created. So the creation of jobs will roughly offset the destruction of jobs in the near future, perhaps different farther out. But that doesn't mean that there's no policy challenge. In fact, there's a major policy challenge, because what that means is workers have to transition to new jobs. They have to get new skills. They have to often move to a new location, new occupation. So even if there's no unemployment effect from automation, there is a very serious social burden created by it. That's the real policy challenge. And that's why we wanted to look at what actually is happening to workers who are affected by automation. So let me start with the background. As I said, many people have sort of confused conceptions about what's involved. First off, we have to be very clear that technology and technological change is more than automation. People have focused on automation artificial intelligence. It's not even clear that automation is the most serious thing. So what else does technology do? Technology creates new products, but that also means old products become obsolete. They create new occupations. Old occupations become obsolete. They create greater capabilities. So we conducted a survey of AI startups to get a picture into what the future is going to look like, because these are the companies that are developing the technology. And one of the questions we asked them was, you know, what are the benefits your customers get from your technology? Two of the benefits were automated routine tasks and reduced labor costs, which are the red bars. But much more important were the benefits that enhanced capabilities, like making better predictions or decisions, managing data better, gaining new capabilities to improve services or products. Those things, the enhancing or augmenting capabilities, were much more important than replacing humans with machines. Now, that's not necessarily all good news either, because these aspects can also lead to greater economic inequality. They can lead to greater domination of markets by large firms. We're seeing these things happening. We're still exploring what the links are between new technology and these trends. But it's important to keep in mind that the most significant impact of artificial intelligence may not be on automation. It may be on some of these other aspects. Okay. The second point is automatable does not mean automated. Before a technology which is your task can be potentially automated, that is potentially automated, can actually be automated, first it has to be adopted. In other words, firms have to find that it makes economic sense. They have to find that it makes organizational sense. And it has to be implemented. They have to gather the complementary personnel, the talent needed to manage. People need to have the skills and knowledge to effectively implement new technologies. So these are significant barriers. If we look at three occupations, so Frey and Osborne decided that these occupations were fully automatable in 2013, given adequate data. Accountants and auditors, loan officers, paralegals, and legal assistants. So the first thing to recognize is that all of these occupations have been undergoing automation for a very long time, since the 1950s or 60s. Loan officers had some of their tasks automated with artificial intelligence in one of the first commercial applications of artificial intelligence in 1987 in terms of detecting credit card fraud. We looked at what some of the startups are developing that address the work of these occupations. And we also asked them, what are some things that the technology doesn't do? And there are real important things that the technology doesn't do. So it's hard to see that these are actually fully automatable. And the process of taking the technology that's available today and putting it in place to automate these occupations seems that there's a lot more involved in fully automating an occupation than just simply the theoretical possibility. In fact, the Bureau of Labor Statistics projects that these occupations will continue to grow as they have been growing over the last 10 years. Another point, and this related point, is that what gets automated are tasks, not jobs. Very rarely is an occupation completely automated. And the reason is, with these examples, is that occupations or jobs require many diverse skills. Technology can automate some of those tasks, but often not all of them. So I did a study looking at the 270 detailed occupations listed in the census in 1950 and asked which ones are around and which ones have been automated out of existence. And first off, most of them are still around. Some, like boarding house keepers, went away because demand changed. A few, like telegraph operators, disappeared because their industry became obsolete. And I found one, only one, that was really automated out of existence. Anybody want to guess? Elevator operator. And actually, you can still find, there's some 10,000 still around, but for all intents and purposes, they've been automated out of existence. But, you know, if you go back and you look at what these occupations do that machines can't do, it's really quite significant. An accountant has to evaluate and advise their clients on organizational controls. This isn't something you just feed some data into a machine and spit out. It requires human judgment. It requires organizational knowledge. It's more complex. And similarly for loan officers and paralegals. All right. Number four, even if you automate some tasks, the occupation can still grow in employment, or the industry can still grow in employment. Now, we tend to think that if we automate tasks, that we're going to lose jobs. And I think that sensibility is largely informed by our experience with manufacturing. So this is a chart showing the number of textile wage earners in the U.S. It was over 400,000 in the late 1940s, and it's under 20,000 today. Part of that is because of globalization, but the biggest part of it, because there wasn't all that much globalization before 2000 in this industry, is from technology. That's automation. But that's not the whole picture. This is the whole picture. If we go back to the early 19th century, what we see is that we experienced over 100 years of intense automation accompanied by employment growth. And it's not unique to the textile industry. We can see it in steel, in automotive. We see it today. The barcode scanner came in the 1980s in big form. It automated 18 to 19% of the work that a cashier did in checking out people in a grocery store, but the number of cashiers grew. Legal discovery systems, it's a $1 billion industry today. There's a lot of it being done. It's widely deployed, but the number of paralegals has also grown since 2000. My favorite example is the ATM machine and the bank teller. The dashed line shows the number of ATM machines in the U.S. From 95 to 2005, a huge increase, but the number of bank tellers actually grew. So what's going on? How is it that automation can destroy jobs at one time and create them at another time? And what does that mean for how we think about what's going on today? And the big thing that everybody forgets about is demand. So what happened with textiles? Automation came in and it reduced the amount of labor required to produce a yard of cloth, which in a competitive market reduced the price. And there was so much pent-up demand that people, when the price went down, they bought a lot more. In fact, they bought so much more that the net effect was to increase employment of textile workers. So this shows on a logarithmic scale, if that doesn't confuse you, the increase in the per capita consumption of cotton cloth in the U.S. And, today we consume 20 times as much cloth as somebody consumed in the early 19th century. Typical person back then had one set of clothing. The price went down. There was this huge pent-up demand. They bought a lot more cloth. Employment grew. Today, though, we have full closets. We're using cloth and, upholstery, draperies, all sorts of things. Today, the automation is chugging away. In textiles for 200 years now, it's been about a 3% per year gain in output per worker, or output per hour. And today, the price may go down, but it's not going to generate the same demand because why? Demand is satiated. We have all the cloth we need. We're not going to buy that much more. So in the 19th century, elastic demand meant that price declines from automation would dramatically increase demand and offset the labor-saving effect of the technology. Today, the labor-saving effect dominates, and that's why employment goes down. So we can think about similar things with today's technology. The automated teller machine made it cheaper for banks to open up bank branches. They wanted to compete geographically, so they opened up a lot more bank branches, and the number of tellers decreased, even though they needed far fewer tellers per branch. Similarly, electronic discovery. They made it cheaper and easier to discover electronic documents, and so requests for the number of documents in discovery and litigation went way, way up. Ultimately, it's an empirical question, and I'll get back to what that demand effect is in the future. But I want to make one more point, which is that even when industries lose jobs, the economy as a whole can still grow. So my colleagues David Otter and Anna Salomons looked at what happens when industries increase their productivity. Those industries often lost jobs, but there were effects on their suppliers, on their downstream customers, and on consumer income. And so when they looked at the national level, they found that even though the industries might lose jobs, national employment grew. So there were these macroeconomic effects as well. All right, so what's actually going on today? What do we know? I mean, we can observe what's happening in the recent past about a variety of technologies. First off, I think the general thing, this comes from our study of, now these are Dutch firms. The thing we observe, and this is just sort of the most basic piece of background information, the top line shows firms that automate, and the bottom line shows firms that don't. And this is their employment growth, the logged employment growth. So what you see is that automating firms are growing faster. Now, that's important. It's not conclusive, but it's certainly at odds with the view that automation is creating mass unemployment. So the strong form of the mass unemployment hypothesis we can pretty easily reject, and we see similar things from other studies in other countries. There's a more difficult question is, well, it's still possible that those top firms, top-line firms, could have grown faster without the automation. In other words, we can ask a counterfactual. We can ask, how much would they have grown otherwise without the automation, and perhaps that more jobs would have been created. And so economists have ways of trying to tease that out. They're always a little bit controversial. But here's a summary of a dozen studies that have been done in the last few years. different countries, the top group are looking at information technology and AI. The second group, automation generally. The third group, industrial robots, which tend to be a much smaller thing. The overall picture is only one of these studies finds an unambiguous negative result. Some of them find losses in, say, manufacturing, but growth in services, or losses for production workers and growth in other workers or net workers. But it's very clearly not a situation where we're seeing across the board job losses. That's significant. I mean, if we put this in the context of thinking about demand, what that's saying is, we have some industries where there is large pent-up demand and automation leads to job growth. We have other industries, perhaps manufacturing sector, for instance, where continued automation is going to lead to continued job loss. Is it different this time? A lot of people argue that things are different, and I'll certainly agree. We're looking at changes which may be faster, which may affect a broader swath of the economy. But think about demand here. If demand is elastic, faster automation means faster job growth. And demand doesn't change very quickly. What the historical studies show is that it changes slowly. In 30 years we may have, or 50 years we have satiated demand, but if the health services sector is seeing elastic response to automation today, or finance is seeing elastic response, that's likely going to continue, even though we may see a more rapid pace of change. People have predicted massive job loss over and over through history, and the thing they always forget, including someone like Keynes, is demand. Demand's an important factor. Keynes predicted 90 years ago that we would all be on a 15-hour work week in 100 years. Now, the thing is, if we continue the standard of living that people had in 1930, we would have been on a 15 work week in 1977. But what's happened is, implicitly, we've found more things that we want to buy. We opt for work more than leisure time. The average work week has declined. It's about 34, 35 hours in OECD countries now. But we're wanting to work a lot more because we demand more things. So it's difficult to estimate human desire, and it seems particularly hazardous to underestimate human desire when talking about automation. So there may be a real problem 50 years from now when more industries have their demand satiated, but we're facing a real crisis today, a real socially disruptive impact from automation, and that's the real challenge we need to think about. Okay, so let me get on to our study on what happens to the workers when firms automate. So it turns out that the Netherlands... Excuse me, let me get some water here. The Netherlands has been collecting data on firm automation expenditures since 2000. And that's unique and fairly helpful because there really isn't a lot of data out there about automation. They also have very rich data on firms and workers, so we're able to go and look at, this very detailed information about workers at a plant that automates what happens in 5 years in terms of their use of unemployment insurance or disability benefits, things like that. To analyze this data, these data, we looked at what we call automation spikes. The idea is, it turns out that a lot of investments in technology and in automation in particular, happen in major episodes. It's so-called lumpy investment. A firm will come along and they'll spend nothing or very little for year after year, and then all of a sudden, bam, they'll put a major investment in. So we call that a spike. It provides us an episode where we can look and see very cleanly what happened to the workers at that firm before and after. And what we do is we compare the workers at that firm to a control group of very similar firms, in particular firms that will spike in 5 years later. And in doing this, we're studying the results I'm about to show you concern what we call incumbent workers, workers who have been there 3 or more years. It turns out if you look at the ones who were hired more recently, they don't see much negative effect from automation. But there is a very distinct negative impact for the incumbent workers at firms that automate relative to the control group. So I'm going to show you a series of charts like this. The zero line is the year that the automation occurred, and what you see is this is a log or the relative wage salary income of the workers, of all the workers at the plant, and it goes down at the starting the year of the automation event, and 5 years out, there's an 11% loss of 1 year's salary, so which turns out to be just under 4,000 euros. Equivalent of $4,000, roughly. So there's a significant loss. It's not overwhelming. Of course, it's concentrated on a smaller portion of the people at that firm, but this is the average loss of all workers at that firm. There are two ways they can lose income. One is their wages can go down, the wage rate can go down. The other is they're working less. The wage rate does not change much, but in fact, their non-employed days goes up. So either they are working less at the firm, or most of the time it's really a story of they leave the firm and they're unemployed for a while before they get another job. And in fact, we can look at the percentage of workers who leave. So the year of the automation event, about 2% workers will leave relative to the control group. And that there then is a trickle of workers who continue to leave over the next several years. We don't know whether they're leaving because they've been laid off or they decided to leave. Data don't tell us that, and often it's hard to distinguish anyway. But, you know, we're seeing a significant but not overwhelming effect. So we have the Dutch safety net. In the U.S., we tend to think of Europe as having a very, you know, thick, supportive safety net. Here we looked at unemployment benefits, welfare benefits, and disability benefits. And particularly, the total benefits rose for those groups of workers. Actually, disability benefits fell for some technical reasons. Most of it was from unemployment insurance. But here's the key takeaway, which is the amount that they got in benefits over 5 years is only 13% of the income they lost. In other words, the safety net is not helping them very much compared to the actual burden that automation is imposing on them. So where do they go? About 20% of them go to new industries. They're not changing in terms of they're not going to low-wage firms or low-wage occupations. They're not going to smaller firms or larger firms. It's pretty much similar. Some more go into self-employment or early retirement. Not huge numbers, though. Who's affected? So in our sample, the impressive thing is that automation is affecting a huge number of workers every year. 9% of the workers in our sample were at firms that were automating each year. Now, of course, when a firm automates, it doesn't automate all workers in the firm. But, you know, we're still seeing, you know, a very broad swath of the economy being affected each year. In all non-financial sectors, our study didn't cover finance, so it's not just about manufacturing, it's not just about robots, all workers. pretty much equivalent by gender, by wage. Both high-wage workers and low-wage workers, and maybe even high-wage workers, had a bit more of a loss, by both small firms and large firms. And the only result that really stands out strongly is that older workers were more severely affected. Older workers who leave, for instance, will have a harder time finding a new job and will spend more days unemployed or non-employed. It may be helpful to think about this in comparison to the mass layoff literature. So there's this large literature in economics where people have looked at what happens to workers when firms shut down, when plants lay off 30% or more of their workforce. These events happen for a variety of reasons. Global trade, of course, is a big one. Demand shifts, technological obsolescence in some cases, mismanagement in other cases. And so it's established that people go through periods of unemployment. They have reduced wages both in the near term and in the long term. There's a long-term loss of daily wage rates, what's called wage scarring. So workers who are at these plants that shut down or lay off heavily, their you know, future prospects for a long period of time are adversely affected. These people consume less. They have poor health outcomes. So that, you know, there's a real significant impact. So how does mass layoff compare to automation by these numbers? Well, one thing is mass layoffs are fast. You know, a plant shuts down, 30% of people are laid off, boom. What we see is slow. We see 2% of workers leave the first year, then a trickle more over the subsequent years. With mass layoffs, we're seeing a permanent wage reduction. With automation, we're not. In aggregate terms, both in the Dutch economy and in the U.S. economy, about 4 to 5% of workers are affected by mass layoffs each year. Pretty substantial number. Doing a back-of-the-envelope calculation on our Dutch figures, we come away with about 1% of workers leave their employers each year as a result of automation. So it's a smaller effect. It adds to the burden of mass layoffs, but it's somewhat more modest, although maybe more long-term. So how do we think about this for policy? Are we facing imminent mass unemployment, you know, being overtaken by the robots, the robocalypse, as some people call it? No. The problem is transitions to new jobs. It's very much like the mass layoff literature in the kinds of problems and the kinds of policies we need to think about. So if we're talking about people transitioning to new industries, new occupations, new locations, we need to think about training, work-study arrangements or apprenticeship arrangements so people can get experience with new technologies. We need to certify new skills so that people who have the new skills get recognized by their employers and the labor market responds effectively. That's been well established, particularly with new technologies. There are new kinds of skills required, and employers just have a hard time telling who's got those skills and who doesn't. We need to provide temporary support. The level of unemployment benefits, at least in the Netherlands, doesn't seem very supportive of people making a transition. We also need to think about the things that may be affecting geographic mobility. As many of you know, employee mobility has declined for the last 10 or 20 years in the U.S., measured in terms of job changes, measured in terms of occupation changes, and also measured in terms of geographic mobility. Some people argue, and there's some evidence, that land use policies or housing policies have a negative effect, that in many cases the cities where the jobs are exceedingly expensive. So the policies that can deal with that or deal with, I see Marx in the room, you know, deal with the revitalizing other areas of the country and creating jobs in new locations may be important. We also need to think about policies that encourage labor markets and new skills. So we have policies today that seem to have gotten worse in terms of restricting employee mobility. So things like non-compete agreements, particularly for technical workers. Trade secrecy laws have been expanded. There's the so-called, I won't go into the details, but in many states it's possible for employers to effectively impose a non-compete terms on leaving employees, even though they haven't signed a non-compete agreement. The so-called inevitable disclosure requirements. Occupational licensing provides a friction in terms of people switching occupations or moving. We also want to think about standardizing knowledge so that knowledge of new technologies can spread more broadly. Things like open standards or government attempts to encourage knowledge sharing are possible. So in a sense, to conclude, the future's already here. We've been experiencing automation, and we're going to continue it. It may accelerate, but we're already seeing large numbers of workers experiencing the effects, and it looks something like we already know about. It looks like mass layoffs. So you can think about it in a way not as some, you know, dramatic apocalyptic change that's going to completely upend the economy. You can think of it as a deepening or a worsening of the effects that we see in mass layoffs, extended to more firms and more sectors of the economy. And this does, even though we're not seeing the robocalypse, we are facing a major policy challenge. Thank you.
I'm not very tech savvy. Okay, I first want to thank Jim for presenting this interesting research he and his colleagues are doing. I think that there were a lot of really nice features of this work that he talked about, and I think in some respects, I think it sort of illustrates the types of work I think people should be doing. The central question here, I think, when reading the paper, was that, you know, given the best empirical evidence, what are the best policy options to kind of mitigate harms imposed on workers by the adoption of automation? And what do I mean? I think, you know, in the subtext of this work that they're doing, in addition to sort of introducing, am I walking away?
Yeah.
Sorry. So while Anna sets me up, so I think part of what's missing in a lot of the discussion around this issue is this idea of let's make our policy or make our wants, our desires in terms of policy based in sort of an empirical reality. And like I said, I go to a lot of places and I hear people talk about, oh yeah, this. Like, what did you call it, robot apocalypse? Robocalypse. I mean, I think that's interesting, but none of the evidence that I've seen in of many of the papers that you'll see today actually present anything close to that. And so I think of, you know, some of this work, or a good theme for this work is an implicit plea for evidence-based policy, to go back to the Obama-era characterization of how we should make policy. Okay, and so going back over the background that Jim presented real quick, you know, a number of studies predict large losses, but none of the studies that actually look at the real data actually find evidence of really big losses, aside from the, you know, very special case of the introduction of robotics into the automobile industry. And so the question that sort of arises is, should we really be thinking about what's going on now and comparing it to a lot of the work that went on in the 80s that focused on the effect of plant closures, the 80s up until now, there's still people working on this stuff, that focuses on plant closures and mass layoffs, where they saw these really dire impacts on workers. I mean, like whole towns going virtually unemployed, lots of negative health effects, lots of negative wage effects, people essentially heavily moving into disability programs. It sort of begs the question, is this the right comparison? And I think from the work that Bessin and some of the other work that we've seen in the literature is that no, not yet anyway, right? We don't know what the long run is going to be, notwithstanding Keynes. we don't really know what the long run is going to look like, but at least in the short term, it looks like there are things that we can do to kind of mitigate harms because we don't expect to see a lot of people in food lines anytime soon. Okay, and so so let's talk a little bit about their empirical work, and then we'll come back around to sort of big picture ideas. One of the really nice things about this work is that they actually use these unique administrative data to study firms and workers, okay? And now most of what they talked about was what happened to the workers' experience, individual worker experience in this case, right, around investment spikes. But one of the things I think that they should be focusing on, too, is also the firms. And I'll talk about that more in a second. What's going on here? Okay, so some very interesting results emerge. Workers exposed to relatively early automation spikes are more likely to experience job transitions, earnings losses, and more likely to switch industries, which is interesting, right? Because given some of the graphs that he presented, it didn't look like a lot of those companies were going away. They were actually growing at the time. So I think that's an interesting aspect that I think should be studied more. As expected, given other work, is older workers are more severely affected. But ultimately, there's a small net loss in should be employment. Sorry about that. Unemployment overall. Small loss in employment overall, in large part because there were offsetting hires that newer workers were brought in once the old workers were sort of eased out. Okay, so as I said before, I kind of disagree with some of the conclusions that Jim was made at the end, is that I don't see this experience of automation as looking very much like these mass layoffs, right? I mean, we're talking about, you know, everybody giving a pink slip. I know a number of people who were affected by that. That doesn't seem to be happening. And so, but I do agree with Jim in the sense that I think that policy should be focusing on these job-to-job transitions, right? Easing the harm associated with actually leaving a job, losing your job for a small period of time, and moving to the next job, whatever that might be. That could be pre and post training, additional training, or after a short spell of unemployment, or going back to school and doing a full retraining curriculum. We should be investing in education and training. We should be thinking about what the nature of income supports here, right? So one of the interesting things is we're talking about a European country, and he said that the unemployment system didn't really support the workers very well. They didn't make up their income. And so it makes me think, well, you know, if we want to mitigate harm, if we want to make sure that we maintain dynamism in our economy, one of the ways that we can do that is to ensure that we have sufficient income supports for people who need to change jobs. Relocation subsidies. Some people have argued that one of the reasons we don't see nearly as much mobility here in the United States to work is because the costs of living in the places where work is, you know, a lot of the major metros, is quite high. When people do their cost-benefit calculations to decide whether they want to move or not, they just see it's just too cost prohibitive. And so in some respects, you know, spending some money on relocation subsidies might actually be helpful in terms of moving people to new work. I was reading in the I want to say the New York Times the other day that that New York City is giving subsidies to people to move to Georgia, homeless people. And so I think that we could definitely find some money for to move people to actual work. Again, I thought this was a really nice use of administrative data to study the impacts of automation. And I think that the other thing that, you know, he touched on it a little bit, but this is important, is that they're capturing all automation expenditures here. So some of the early papers focused a lot, because of that's where the data are, on robotics technology. But, you know, I also think it would be interesting to kind of figure out what are these actual expenditures. So I think, you know, spending some time to kind of disaggregate how much of this is actual just transition costs that are built into these this automation expenditures, how much of this is spent on actual technology, how much is it spent on support staff, which might actually, in an aggregate sense, sort of mask some of the potential unemployment effects. We don't really know. But I think it would be interesting to kind of dig in into the data a little more on that on that margin. You know, one of the things that sort of stuck out to me, and I think what, you know, he showed the graph, this graph right here. I thought this graph was the most interesting graph in the paper. Why? Because not only do we find that the automating firms tend to be more dynamic and growing and, you know, look like they're actually flourishing while non-automating firms are not. There's also evidence that at the initial point, at least in the data, that there were level differences between the two types of firms. And so it sort of, you know, sticks out in my mind. I'm an economist, so I think about selection a lot. And I want to think about it a little more carefully. I would love for them to get in and look at the types of firms who are deciding to make that choice to go into automation, spend the money, and also sort of relate that to other sort of aspects of the environment around that, right? Are there things that the Dutch government is doing to incentivize certain firms to move towards automation and others? Are there certain features of their composition, whether it be their management composition or their worker composition, that makes it that the dynamic firms seem to be moving towards including automation into their production processes, and firms that look a little more stagnant, at least in terms of the data, to not move in that direction, right? Especially given the lumpiness of these investments. These are serious choices being made, and it would be interesting from both sort of a general economics perspective to understand who's selecting into automation early, right, because some of these firms do it later as well, but also to think a little more carefully about how policy is affecting that, right? There are pre-existing policies that might be pushing some firms towards automation or certain types of automation, going back to my question about the disaggregation of expenditures. And we need to learn a little more about that to be able to plan and form policy for the future, especially if the future is going to look like this and not one in which we have massive unemployment. Okay, last thing I wanted to talk about was this issue of you know, business cycles. Now, they have a large observation period, and what was interesting to me in that I didn't see was any sort of discussion about the experiences of workers affected by automation in times when the economy is booming versus times when the economy is in a recession, right? And I wonder how much of that overall effect that they're estimating is driven by the recession, okay, that went on in during that time period. And so I would like to see some more work on that, right? And then if we do learn something about that, what are the implications for policy in this case, right? If it's a lot of counter-cyclical features that we need to build in better sort of counter-cyclical features, then that should be, we know how to do that as a modern economy. I mean, we've seen this before. But if it is the case that the workers are seeing similar outcomes regardless of what the overall aggregate macroeconomic environment looks like, then we need to think about what are better policies in this case that we can potentially institute to ease those job-to-job transitions that we need. So anyway, just to conclude, I think this is a very interesting research program. There's lots of room to learn more. Given this complementary work in other countries, showing that, you know, it's just a trickle, not really a mass unemployment events, we need to sort of think about what works best in these other countries and try to apply those things here in the U.S. Thank you.
Marcus, would you like me to moderate the Q&A? I can't remember my role now. Okay. I'll stay here. Shall I stay here, if you don't mind? This is a better... Okay. So we have some time on the schedule. I'd like to thank both speakers for remaining on time to allow time for Q&A and look at the other speakers and hope that they will follow suit. But we'll open it up. We have a distinguished crowd here to either the speaker or the discussant or for general discussion. So if you could just let me know by raising your hand you'd like to speak, and I suggest that we'll take two or three, if that's okay, Marcus and James, and then can come back to you and do a couple of rounds. So we'll start over here with Martin. And the way these work, you have a button in the middle. When it's red next to the little speaky thing, it means that it's on. But you do, as for the speakers, have to bring you have to bring it pretty close to be able to hear you. Martin.
Okay, thanks, Richard. Hopefully it's close enough. So congratulations, Jim, on a terrific paper. I thought it was a great summary of some of the prior work and quite interesting new work that you presented today. My first comment is I really like the way you have renamed the remainder principle, which I always thought was poor branding. Automatable does not mean automated is a much clearer explanation or catchphrase to be able to communicate that notion. The work by Anna Solomons and David Autor that you referenced, the Brookings paper that they gave here in this room, not only shows a relationship between productivity and employment, but also between productivity and wages. Now, we would argue perhaps that we haven't seen a robust enough wage increase associated with productivity improvements, but it does exist in the data. And I'm just wondering, for those who remain in firms that deployed automation, where did they see a step up in their wage gains or somehow benefit themselves by being able to function and provide labor support in a more highly productive organization?
Thank you, Martin. I forgot to ask people to say who they were.
Oh, sorry. Martin Fleming, Chief Economist, IBM.
Right. Thank you.
Can I make one other point?
Of course. Briefly. I'll let others in.
The related and ties to Marcus's comments. If we look at the work Nick Bloom and Eric Bjarnolofsson and John Van Rieten have done, they find that the more highly productive organizations are those who have stronger management practices and capabilities. And we've seen that in the data over many years. There's a relationship between the deployment of technology and the ability to manage and function in a much more effective way. So it'd be interesting to see if the firms who have benefited have are somehow idiosyncratic in their industry or differ in some fundamental way.
I think that's Marcus's selection point too, isn't it? Are they just stronger firms in some other way?
Exactly.
Anyway, okay, yeah, the gentleman there, right at the end. Don't forget to turn your mic on and bring it close. That's it, and then bring it really close.
Thank you.
Chris McCray, Norman Cray Foundation. So my father worked at The Economist all his life, and his favorite subject was your subject in terms of how can we make sure that we create more jobs as technology sort of accelerates. the perspective my father had was very much to do with Moore's law, in terms of if technology is sort of increasing a hundredfold in certain respects, whether that's satellite telecommunications, whether that's the ability of a computer to have a far huger analytical brain than ourselves, then we needed to keep ahead every decade on the assumption that there would be more innovative change in terms of skills that were needed in each decade than a whole generation previously. And that led my father to believe that we radically had to change education to be lifelong and skills relevant. So my question is, which branches of economists still follow that kind of idea? I understand maybe labor economists, but I mean, how do we... There seem to be two segments of economists, those who want to create jobs out of changing the world around things. I just wanted to add one last thing, which is my father was actually tutored by Keynes for a year in Cambridge, 1947. Keynes changed his mind. He said there would be a huge amount of work provided we went to making the number one systemic goal of all economists of being ending poverty, which is the same goal as SDG 1 is now.
Okay, thank you. Your father was Hamish, is that right?
Father was Norman McRae.
Norman McRae, okay.
Thank you.
Good channeling. Okay, yeah, there actually, behind Alan, against the wall. So if you come up to sit next to Alan Berube, he won't bite. Press the button in the middle, and then, yeah, there you go.
My name is Yasmin Hilpert.
Bring it a bit closer. Sorry, it's a general comment. These are annoying. You have to. Don't be shy, just yank.
So my name is Yasmin Hilpert. I'm a senior policy director at the Global Federation of Competitiveness Councils. And I had a couple of comments regarding the presentation. One was, I think you mentioned it as well. I came in a little bit later, so I'm sorry if I maybe missed a few aspects. But the employment effects of automation seem to vary quite strongly across industries, and industries vary geographically, right? So, and you mentioned it later, Marcus, in your comments regarding the relocation, but I think one of the effects that, in light of automation, is probably the strongest is not really the fact that we are facing mass unemployment, but that we are facing an an increasing urban-rural divide. And so, I think what would be interesting is to get your perspectives a little bit on the future development of areas, for example, comparing something like the San Francisco Bay Area to something like West Virginia, where we're already facing really precarious situations. And then when we talk about relocation subsidies, I think it would be interesting. I think it's a really good idea, but then what happens to those areas where people leave from? Because those are essentially left with their... with their skilled people leaving the area. And I come from Germany, so I wanted to offer two sort of maybe best practices, I think, because I really think that exchanging ideas globally would be an important one in this aspect. And one is the so-called solidarity package in Germany, which was established in 1993, I believe, after the fall of the wall, where the western states of Germany were essentially supporting the eastern states, and they are still to this day. So this is something that is still going on. And then the second aspect, obviously, when we talk about just transition and transitioning people into new jobs, the one from the Ruhr area after the coal mining came down. And the last thing I wanted to make a comment about was about the graph that you pulled up later regarding the effects of automation on the numbers of workers in a plant. I think it would be interesting to see what the starting situation of those companies are and the starting situation in terms of technological advancements, because I think that varies quite strongly. So I can imagine that, let's say, the aerospace industry will vary strongly from the paper industry, for example. Paper industry in the U.S. is basically, by global comparison, at a state of the 80s still. And that is something that I think would have an impact on how that curve develops and whether that curve sort of develops into an end curve rather than a sort of steeper curve upwards.
Because it's a different sector, just to be clear.
Yeah.
Okay, fine. So I'll come back to the speaking discussant, and then hopefully we'll have time for another round as well. So from Martin's questions really were about the selection effects that I think you'd already mentioned, and then wages of those who remain in the firm and the productivity link. Chris's point was about this acceleration, the Moore's Law point, channeling your father, and where you kind of still, is it getting faster and faster, and what does that mean for job growth versus poverty prevention? And Yasmin's point about geography, left behind places, do we have to think geographically more strongly? And then offered a couple of ideas around solidarity packages and mobility packages. So, James, why don't we start with you and then Marcus?
Yeah, thanks, everybody. And thanks, Marcus, for your comment. Is it on? You can hear?
When the red light is on, it's on. You need the red light to be on, and then it's on.
That's
Marcus is on.
That's the problem.
No, it doesn't work.
Okay.
It's the technology.
great. So let me, I guess I got to be fairly brief here. So a number of people brought up selection issues, and this is something that we actually looked at quite a bit. We also have very limited data. We don't find much of anything that predicts which firms are going to, given the data we have, we don't find much of anything that predicts which firms are going to automate and when they're going to automate. We did look at business cycle, and interestingly in this study, and this is true in some of the other work we're doing, we don't find significant business cycle effects. Firms are just as likely to automate in 2008, 2009 as they were in 2003 or 4. It is very much, though, the firms that automate tend to be the firms that are growing faster. They are probably, I'm speculating now, they are probably better managed. They probably have better technical capabilities. But there's a lot more research done to we understand that. Let's see. In terms of wages, so we're not seeing much of a wage effect here. Some of the other studies do see wage effects. What we did see, so the incumbent worker wages don't change much. What we do see is that they're bringing, even the year or two before the automation event, they are bringing in some higher paid workers. So, again, there's some lacks in the data, so we don't have a very clear picture about who those workers are or what their capabilities are, but there is something going on there. And some of the other studies are seeing wage effects, a polarizing sort of wage effect. Education. You know, I think, you know, some of these ideas about lifelong learning and we're talking about really a change. Societies need to change the whole philosophy of education and what it's intended to do. And, you know, this idea that we have to abandon, we're no longer in a world where you learn when you're 20 years old and it's good for a lifetime. The urban-rural divide is very interesting. Unfortunately, we don't get much of a handle on that in the Netherlands. so we're looking at some other data, U.S. data, but I think that's probably going to be a very interesting angle, but I can't say much. And then finally, in terms of differences across sectors or industries, you know, we're finding a similar effect across all industries. There's some differences. The impacts in manufacturing on unemployment and income tend to be a bit worse. In accommodations and I forget the other part of the way the sector was grouped in the Dutch data. You know, we're finding very modest effects, but that's also the sector that has the least automation. So it's not clear that we're not able to sort of parse things out into very fine industries, which where we might see some real differences of the sort you mentioned.
Thanks, Jim. Marcus,
just
do you want to add a point?
To jump in real quick, so one of the this result about similar sort of no business cycle effects across industry sort of I think maybe speaks to sort of demographic change in these countries, right? Industrialized countries, the aging of the population seems like it might speak to kind of the issues that firms, especially that these are dynamic firms, growing firms are more likely to automate than ones that are not growing. It might be labor shortages due to the fact that they just don't have the workers that they need, partly through the aging of the population, that might provide more incentive to automate. And just a quick point on the urban-rural divide. Part of my the relocation subsidies thing would be potentially giving incentives to firms to move. But, you know, given the sort of changes in our overall preferences for being around the major cities, plus the agglomeration economies, it sort of seems like a hard thing. And this is an issue of considerable debate among urban economists, right, is this issue of you know, how much should we invest in place-based policies versus sort of providing people incentives to move to work. And to this point, the evidence isn't really good on place-based policies. Now, I'm actually a proponent, it puts me in bad odor in some circles, of place-based policies for the precise reason, because you can't move everybody to opportunity, so to speak. You know, and so I think in some respects, one of the debates we'll have going forward, at least here in the U.S., is how much are we going to expect for other states to redistribute to less well-off places, especially given that the preferences and the job growth and all that tends to be going on in these major metros. Two of my colleagues here, or one of my colleagues here, Mark Moreau, just recently published a report in Metro on precisely this issue. So I think that is an important issue, and I think that's going to become much more politically divisive going forward, because we're talking about sort of redistributing across states in a decentralized system like the one like we have in the U.S.
Yeah, I noticed that Joe Biden also just picked up the idea of heartland visas, to offer immigrant visas to people who are going to go and work in particular areas, which is something that EIG has written about and that Mark has written about too. I think he just did that. So there are all kinds of place-based policies, right? Okay, we're about 10 minutes, so let's try and do at least another round. There's two down here, yeah.
Thank you. Dave Rabinowitz, retired. Dr. Casey made a very important point, and that is you have to look behind the numbers. If you just look at the numbers, you're going to be blindsided. And economists tend to be blindsided a lot.
Now, they do like numbers, that has to be said.
But they don't look behind them. And this is a topic. Automation is a technology topic. I look at the lineup of speakers today. There's one journalist and everybody else is an economist. I don't see any technologists here. So I'm wondering how relevant the outcome of all this is actually going to be. And in defense of Keynes, it's not enough to take some of his quotes out of context. You have to read the whole paper, Economic Possibilities for Our Grandchildren, because he makes some very relevant points.
I couldn't agree with you more about reading the whole thing. As to whether or not it'll have any impact, well, let's hope for it. But anyway, let's keep going. The lady next to you.
Ariane Hegewisch, Institute for Women's Policy Research. Firstly, I'm very glad you kind of debunked the unemployment effect and focused more on the restructuring of jobs. One of the issues, though, we all cite the bank teller impact, that the study that you had, that there was the unemployment loss was much slower, but we checked recently and the jobs have disappeared and that the conditions have really declined. So I think one of the lessons perhaps is that the change is coming more slowly and obviously feeds into other structural demand changes and consumer demand. Two questions. One on that very interesting chart of the innovating versus the non-innovating firms. Do you have data of what proportion of employment each of those firms represent? Because EPI has done here, Economic Policy Institute here has done very interesting work on the monopolization in the labor market, or monopsonization, I guess. And so feeding that into the very slow growth in real wages that we're seeing. So, you know, I'm just wondering who's swallowing up who and what are the sectors presenting. And the third issue is we work a lot on the kind of office work, where those jobs that present stepping stone jobs into the middle class for women who don't need a college degree. And where there seems to be, you're not quite sure what's going on, but there seems to be some change, and the innovations there often are cheaper than if you have to buy a robot and automate a factory. So, and it's also spread out more across the whole country.
Could you give an example? Sorry to interrupt, but...
You know, secretaries, kind of basically travel agents. You don't have to book your, you know, don't need travel agents anymore. You don't need less typing. And West Virginia, now you can't get a full-time job in office work, right? You get a $9 job part-time, even if you have an associate degree in office work, right? So, and there was a very good article yesterday in the Washington Post that picked up some individual stories. So I'm just wondering those kind of the big innovations versus the cheaper innovations and the impact on gender.
Mark.
Good. Can you hear, Jeff? Great. I just wanted to thank Jim again for more totally sensible, you know, grounded, firm-based, granular work. And I wonder if that focus might have led you to unveil anything about transitions within firms. I think we're all getting very interested in incumbent worker transitions, and noting that that may be the first opportunity for either a good or a bad transition. So I wonder if anything surfaced in this interesting administrative data on that front. And again, thanks so much for joining us.
All right, I'm going back to the speakers. You have four minutes. So that's 2 minutes each if you allocate it in an egalitarian fashion. I won't summarize, just in the interest of time.
Okay, so quickly. I mean, the purpose of the ATM bank teller story isn't to say that bank tellers are never.
You can hear? I just wasn't talking into it. Bank tellers are permanently protected in their occupations, but that particular technology did not appear to adversely impact them. Now, it turns out that since the end of that study, the banks have actually been reducing the number of bank branches. And there are new technologies. Online banking is coming on and is a very big thing. And, yeah, we're seeing some modest declines in the number of bank tellers, but not a drastic decline. So it's hard to say. In terms of monopsony and firm size, so we're seeing that this automation is taking place both at small firms and at large firms. Large firms more so, both in relative and absolute terms. It's not just the largest firms. Gender and the cost of innovation. I think it's very hard. It's very hard to generalize. We're not seeing big gender differences in what we're, you know, what we're seeing here in the Dutch data. You have to remember some of the implementations of systems that automate back office jobs are huge and they're expensive and they're you know, it's not. I'm not sure that there's a clear correlation there. Transitions within firms. We weren't seeing, in terms of the measures that we have, which are in some ways limited, we're not seeing things like wage effects. I have other sources of data. I went to a very interesting meeting with top large firm human resources managers, or there's a new acronym and I'm forgetting what it is, but that's who they are. It's very interesting that a lot of these firms were struggling with ways to get people new skills within the firm. There are the obvious things like training and internal training programs and that's well known. You're seeing some significant efforts there, particularly by some of the larger firms. But what's very interesting is they're doing things to encourage mentoring, and they're setting up networks so that
you know, somebody in DuPont gets identified as being the internal expert, regardless of their rank and other qualifications, but internal expert on a particular technology, and they have these techniques for facilitating communication within the firm about that knowledge, which I found pretty interesting. So that's my time.
Any final thoughts, Marcus? Great. Please join me in thanking both Jim and Marcus for that session. And so we're moving on to our next session. I'll introduce our next speaker. Henry Hsu is a professor of economics in Vancouver School of Economics. He's going to be presenting his paper on A Tale of Two Workers, the Macroeconomics of Automation. And then we're going to hear from his discussant, Gabriel. Gabriel, how do I say the surname? Matthew. Okay. Gabriel Matthew, who is Assistant Professor of Economics at AU. So we're going to hear first from Henry and then from Gabriel.
Fantastic. All right, good morning. Thanks so much for having me. Thank you to Gabriel for serving as discussant. This is very much work in progress that my co-authors and I are working on. We are just waiting for the slides to come up. But this is joint work with Nir Haimovich, Itai Sporta-Eckstein, and Yaniv Yedid-Levy. I'm going to tell you now about some work that we've been working on in terms of explicitly thinking about policy proposals and policy experiments that we think might be more or less useful in aiding those who have been most negatively affected by automation in the U.S. So as a large literature has demonstrated, there's been a profound change in the nature of work. The types of jobs that are performed in advanced economies like the U.S. and across essentially all industrialized countries. The primary factor behind this change in the nature of work, not the only factor, but the primary factor is advances in automation technology. And what you see in the U.S. is that there's been a sharp fall in the fraction of the population that's employed in what we refer to in economics as a routine occupation. So this idea of routine comes from thinking about all jobs as being able to, you being able to describe them along two dimensions, routine work versus non-routine work. Routine work is work that focuses on a narrow set of tasks, tasks that can be performed if you follow a well-prescribed set of instructions. So there's routine, non-routine. There's manual versus cognitive. Essentially, manual would be the brawn jobs. Cognitive would be the brain jobs. So you can split all jobs roughly into one of these four quadrants. Okay, so there's been a sharp drop in the fallen fraction of people employed in routine jobs, both routine manual and routine cognitive. And today, you know, I think the punchline of what we've done is we've put together a macroeconomic model to evaluate policy proposals. The punchline, if you want to take a nap, go ahead. I'll just give you the punchline now. All the proposals we consider, you know, things that we've heard people talking about, some are better and others are worse. So promising proposals that that we find within the context of our model is a reform to the UI system, making unemployment insurance benefits more generous, labor income tax reform in terms of magnifying progressivity, large-scale retraining programs. There's an asterisk there. I'll tell you why there's an asterisk there when we get there. There are also some pretty terrible policy ideas within the context of our model, a UBI, not a great thing. Okay, so this is obviously a relevant topic, a relevant search topic nowadays. So if you just type in will space R, apparently this is what Google will propose to you. I have to admit, I had to get one of my co-authors to do this because I'm from Vancouver, as Richard said. You call that the Pacific Northwest. In Canada, we call that the West Coast because we have no Northwest. So it's the West Coast or the Wet Coast. So if you type W-I-L space R, what you get is, will rain in Vancouver when I tried to do this? So anyways, so okay. So again, disappearing job opportunities in routine. These are routine manual jobs. The classic is the machine worker, middle class job, already been in decline according to the BLS. Predicted decline even more in the future. Here's a routine cognitive job. Classic example is a secretary. Already been in decline. Middle class job. Predicted decline even more. Here's just a picture, just, you know, of all the work being done in the U.S. economy from the 1980s to today, lumping the routine manual and routine cognitive jobs in the middle. They've been in decline. High-paying, non-routine cognitive jobs, like policymakers, managers, CEOs, software engineers, economists, growing. Non-routine manual, caretakers, groundskeepers, personal care aides, home health aides, also, especially recently, growing. Okay, so there's two parts to the paper. 35 minutes, I can't talk about both, but there's an empirical part which informs our model construction, okay? And so I'm not going to talk to you about this, you know, in detail, but essentially the idea is, you know, in the 1980s, you could identify someone who was working in a routine job, okay? They had specific characteristics. You know, the question is that we need to address is, if you were somehow able to, like, cryogenically freeze that person and teleport them into today, a lot has changed in the past 40 years. One of the major things is automation. You plop that person down into today, unfreeze them, that person might be able to find work in a routine job, but likely they're not going to be able to find work in a routine job. So the question is, what are those people doing instead? And so that's the kind of thought counterfactual we need to address to be able to make our model analysis relevant. So we developed some new approaches to doing that. One is, you know, matching people on AFQT scores in the NLSY 1979 versus 1997. Another is to, you know, essentially our co-authors, we're automating our own work rather than actually, you know, looking at all those individual level characteristics and trying to, you know, sort people here and there. We're just asking the computer to do it. So that's the new thing. But the punchline is as follows. So if you are somebody who is likely to be a routine worker, you've seen a large fall in the chances that you're doing that kind of work now. So what are they doing instead? You know, as already been discussed by Jim, it's not that these people are more likely to be unemployed nowadays, okay? And it's equally not likely that they've somehow become a software engineer, okay? What's taken up the slack? Of the slack that needs to be taken up, a smaller fraction, a third of it, has been taken up by movements into non-routine manual work, so low-wage work. Much more of it in the U.S. is that they are out of the labor force. They're much more likely to be a non-participant of the labor force. Okay, and this is what's driving, you know, the fall in the U.S. working-age, prime-age labor force participation rate. It's this. Okay, so this serves as guidance into what we think of as an empirically relevant macroeconomic model that we think is fit for policy analysis. You know, it's a general equilibrium model, so rather than a partial equilibrium model, you know, a simple elaboration of an Econ 100 labor supply, labor demand model, we're going to be thinking about equilibrium in the whole economy, so we're going to be thinking about job creation, people making participation and occupational choices in conjunction with other people making investment choices to balance off the whole macroeconomy. There's going to be a heterogeneous agent model, so we're going to explicitly think about, you know, the entire income distribution and how automation affects people in different parts of that income distribution. Automation, obviously, is reflected as an aggregate in the large improvement in welfare, but this masks winners and losers. We're trying to identify who those people are, and we're going to use this model as a lab. The two types of programs that we're thinking about is a retraining program and other redistributive programs. Okay, so I hope I've adapted this presentation sufficiently from an hour and a half down to a 35-minute talk. So here's the basics. You know, we're going to think about two broad classes of workers. They're going to be, you know, the high-skill workers. In economics, we use the word skill and wages synonymously. So they're going to be the high-wage workers. These are the relatively boring people in the model. They're all going to be identical. They only work in the high-paying, non-routine cognitive jobs. Like in the data, these people face very little unemployment, so there's going to be no unemployment among these people in the model. But they do choose how much to work, and we're going to be taxing them. And so, you know, the more you tax them, the less they're going to want to work. Okay? All the action happens among the other people. Well, you know, what's the opposite of high? It's low. I'm not saying that these are all low-skill people. These are going to be the middle class and low-wage workers in our economy. They're going to be heterogeneous, and they're going to be endowed with a workability, a skill in the two occupations that they work in, routine jobs and non-routine manual jobs, okay? And that skill distribution is going to be summarized by gamma, and these people are going to be making the important choices. They're going to choose whether they want to participate in the labor market or whether they want to sit out, and if they decide to participate, they might be unemployed, but they might be working, and they need to choose whether I want to look for a routine job or whether I want to look for a non-routine manual job. They're also taxed on labor income, but at a lower rate. The key thing is that there's also going to be this automation capital. Automation capital, you know, you can think about it as personal computers or robotics. Automation capital substitutes for work done in routine occupations. Firms are going to be making investment decisions on how much automation to adopt. We've got a tax system that features capital income and profit taxation. Who's going to earn, who's going to own these firms and capital? Like in the data, we're going to give them all to the high skill. They're going to be the capitalists. We do that for analytical tractability reasons, but it's a pretty good approximation to the way the real world looks. Okay, so yeah, automation is going to directly benefit the high skilled. This is the only equation I'm going to show you. Maybe I shouldn't even show you. But again, yeah, automation capital, that X, it substitutes for routine work. So if you want to build a car, you either, you know, hire a bunch of, you know, metalsmiths, engine builders, welders, or you just buy a robot to do it, okay? So that, so, you know, you're going to produce a bunch of cars there, you know, you can build the cars, but you got to sell them. You're also going to need high-skilled people to get that out the door. You're going to need market analysts, market researchers. You're going to need managers. You're going to need financial specialists. So the more cars you have to sell, the better it is for the high-skilled individuals. The high-skilled individuals are the red. Low-skilled people, they either choose to work in the routine occupation or in the non-routine manual occupation. And those job openings are going to be created by firms in the standard search and matching literature. We're just going to adopt that. And there's going to be unemployment amongst these people. Okay, one of the key things about the search and matching literature that we think is relevant is the idea that the wages that are going to be negotiated for these low-skilled people, they're going to depend on a bunch of things. It's going to depend on bargaining between the firm and the worker. The key thing here to, you know, to be useful later on is that one of the key ingredients to a low-skilled individual's wage is their outside option of working for that firm. Okay. The government is going to balance a budget. What are the revenues? It's going to be all the income taxes and capital and profit taxes we talked about. What are they going to spend on? They're going to spend on unemployment insurance benefits, and they're going to spend on transfers to people who don't earn an income, transfers to people outside the labor force. And this all comes together in a macroeconomic model. Okay, so the way to picture this is to think about, this is the skills of the low-skilled, so they have an ability in the routine work, in the routine job. They have an ability in the not, in the manual job. So I would be somebody down here. I'm not very skilled. I'm close to 0-0. You folks are picking people over on the other end. You're really good at both things, okay? But there's all kinds of people. There could be people who are bad at manual work but really good at routine work, or they could be really bad at routine work, really good at manual work. Those isobars kind of are trying to represent that if you were to project this into a third dimension, that's where the probability weight is. That's the distribution, okay? And in an occupational choice model, you're going to get a dotted line. Everybody who sits on the dotted line, those are the people who are equally happy given the payoffs of working in the routine job or the manual job, okay? But if you're to the right, you're going to say, oh, it's better for me to work in the routine job. People to the left and to the up, they're going to be better off working in the manual job, okay? Again, like I said, we're going to add into this standard occupational choice framework the idea that, no, if you don't want to work, you're going to get a transfer that's independent of your ability. And so what that means is that there's going to be this yellow box where everybody below this cutoff and that cutoff, they're going to say, you know what, I'm better off being outside the labor force, okay? So that's graphically what our model looks like. Again, because this is a macroeconomic model with a lot of bells and whistles, that diagonal line is in general not going to be a straight line, but we're going to build back into the model assumptions that make it straight. Okay. All right, so now I want to consider, well, what happens when there's automation? So what automation does is it reduces the relative value of working in a routine job. So how do you represent that in this picture? Well, what happens is that that diagonal line, the slope changes. So if I flip back and forth, you can see that with automation, the slope falls, the area in red, it shrinks. Okay? And where are those people going to move to? They're going to move to either manual work or they're going to leave the labor force. And so the key thing we need to do in our model is discipline all the parameter values such that, like I said, of the people who left routine manual work, a third of them went to the blue, but two-thirds of them went to the yellow. So that's going to be the key thing that we want to discipline the model with. And so, yeah, once we get to the policy analysis, what policy analysis is doing is it's essentially either changing the slope of that diagonal line. Automation is going to drive it down. Certain policies can drive that slope back up. Other policies will say, well, that straight diagonal line, it's not going to be a straight diagonal line. You know, you're going to reintroduce the wiggles to it. And a retraining policy says, well, you know, this was the original probability weight map. Maybe retraining can shift that weight away from, you know, these low-skilled people being particularly good at routine work. Maybe we can make them particularly good at manual work. Okay? So that's graphically the nature of the policy proposals that we think about. I'm not going to talk about this. I'm just going to say that how do we, you know, we're macroeconomists are economists that really love numbers. We need to find a way to discipline how much automation has been experienced in the economy, and we're going to use the relative price of ICT capital as our measure. Our model, like many models, the relative price tells us about advances in automation, the productivity of that type of capital. And again, like I said, we want to set the model parameters so that we get this two-thirds, one-third split. You know, if I'm not going to be working routine, with two-thirds probability, I'm going to leave the labor force. With one-third probability, I'm going to stay in the labor force but work in the other job. This is, you know, important from an academic perspective. We don't target the fall in the amount of routine work, so we have some testable, untargeted implications of the model that we can say, oh, this is a pretty good model. One of the things I will just say quickly is there's been this large literature on the fact that, you know, of all of national income in the U.S., and this is true in other economies as well, you can broadly split, you know, national income into labor's share of income and capital share of income. So capital would be profits, dividends, capital gains, okay? And what's true in an economy like the U.S. is that labor's share of the pie has been shrinking. What's also true is that it's not all labor's share has been shrinking. It's been shrinking for the routine, for the middle class. And our model delivers that, okay, broadly speaking. Okay, so to the welfare results. So again, automation is reducing the slope of this diagonal line. And so what you can see is, you know, some people stay who were routine, stay routine. Others leave the labor force. Others go into the other occupation. But again, what also happens is when you get automation, it also draws a bunch of people who were out of the labor force into the labor force, but into the low-paying job. Okay. And so what does our model say about, you know, if I feed in the amount of automation that I've seen over the past 30, 40 years, what does that do in terms of welfare? Well, you can see here in the top box, who loses? It's the people who used to be in routine work. Okay, they're the losers from automation. Who are the winners? Not surprisingly, the high-skilled. They really win. But, you know, they're a small fraction of the population. The losers are the previously middle-class routine workers. Okay, so let me talk quickly now about some policy experiments. So, like I said, we have two broad classes of policy experiments. One is a retraining program. And the idea is that we're going to think about targeting, you know, the people who are negatively affected, these low-skilled individuals who have essentially who have left the labor force. And we're going to train them to become manual workers, okay? So, you know, I don't want you to think about this training program as taking these people and suddenly, oh, sending them to a four-year college and making them computer science majors and getting them a software engineering job. Or I'm not talking about, you know, turning these people into physicians or surgeons. Again, we're training them to do non-routine manual work. So, you know, I think that this comes, you know, it kind of addressed the question as to, you know, why is it that, you know, there are some Americans who, for whatever reason, they're sitting out of the labor force when there are job opportunities available to them in, you know, what we think of as the caring economy. What are the big growth occupations in the U.S.? Home health aides, personal care aides, child care, you know, preschool type of education. You know, this is work that is in high demand. It doesn't require a four-year college degree. How do we nudge Americans into this type of work? The other programs are going to be explicitly redistributive. I'll talk about that later. But it's going to be transferring resources from the high-skilled to the low-skilled. So we're going to retrain those who nowadays, in our post-automation equilibrium, we're going to train the labor force non-participants by offering them, hey, I have a magic pill you can swallow that will just automatically bump up your ability in the manual job by some increment, okay? I'm not, you know, this is a model. I'm not going to be specific about how you do it, but magically take this pill. You're going to be better at manual work, okay? Some people, their manual ability is so low that, you know, I take this pill, I'm still going to be out of the labor force. I'm going to say, I don't want that training program. I'm just going to stay where I am. But others, you know, their ability, it was pretty high, and this is going to put them over the bar. I'm going to say, yes, I'm going to select into that treatment. I select into that training program. I get trained. I become a labor force participant with the eye towards doing manual work, okay? So what we do in our model, in our analysis, is we find that the size of that magic pill to bring labor force participation back to the pre-automation level. Okay, so we're trying to get, you know, the prime working age labor force participation rate back, particularly amongst these individuals. So, you know, this is just to indicate, look at the top line, you know, automation caused labor force non-participation to rise. We're going to bring non-participation back down to its old levels through this retraining program. Who benefits? Not surprisingly, it's going to be the people who are out of the labor force who went into the manual occupation. This is really good for them, okay? But this sort of retraining program, you know, that's what this general kind of this general equilibrium analysis sheds light on is it's not a win for everybody. Who is it a loss for? It's going to be a loss for the people who otherwise were there, but now there's this flood of people who are originally out of the labor force into my occupation. My skill at this job is now less scarce. You know, it's the classic supply effect. The supply effect, you know, drives down the return to being who I am, and what happens is that a bunch of these people, they might stay in that job. They, you know, they lose out by 3.2%. Some of them get driven into the routine job because, you know, there's too many people. This occupation is overcrowded. Some of them leave. Okay, surprisingly, amongst the high skilled, they actually benefit from this kind of retraining program. Okay, now this is a large-scale retraining program to bring the labor force participation rate back. You need to essentially treat 3% of the working population, working age population. So this is big. How much would that cost? We're macroeconomists. We're not education economists, so I don't know how to rig up a production function for manual skills. So we're just going to back of the envelope calculator. Okay. So what happens is that because of this retraining program, You bring all these workers back into the labor force, GDP actually rises by about 1%. Okay? So this 1 divided by 3, that means that if the per participant cost of this retraining program were less than a third of per capita GDP, per capita GDP is big, so a third of it is big. So, you know, if everybody who selects into this retraining program were pretty darn costly, it would still be a net benefit to the economy. Okay? So that's the sense in which I'm saying these kinds of retraining programs, they look promising because they can be pretty costly and they're still, to the economy as a whole, a net beneficial thing. The open question is, do programs like this actually exist? That's what I leave as a question to the floor. 10 minutes. So in terms of the redistribution policies that we study, we're going to study 4 so far. This is, again, work in progress. We've studied 4 so far. One is a increase in the generosity of UI benefits, unemployment insurance. One that people like to talk about is the introduction of a universal basic income. Everybody just gets a pot of money to spend, regardless if you're high-skilled, low-skilled, unemployed, out of the labor force. We can explicitly transfer income to people who are out of the labor force. Or we can, you know, make the labor income tax schedule more progressive. Again, all of these programs, we're going to be thinking about financing them through increased taxation of the high-skilled. Okay. And to make all the experiments comparable, we're going to think about, you know, in all of these experiments, its dollar value equivalent is about $500 per month. Okay, so if we're thinking about the increase in the generosity of unemployment insurance, we're going to say unemployment insurance benefits are going to be more generous by an amount of $500 per month, approximately $6,000 a year. Okay. I don't know if I have time to go through all of them, so by show of hands, who would like to see the UI benefit increase experiment? Who would like to see the UBI? Okay, more people would like to see the UBI. The labor tax reform I'm going to do because it's a nice counterpoint to the others. Okay, so the UI benefits, I'll tell you just very briefly, it's a winner. Everybody benefits if you make unemployment insurance more generous. I could talk about that in the 50 minutes afterwards, okay? The only thing is that the gains are small at the level that is required to bring labor force participation back to what it used to be. The welfare gains are small, but what's true is it's, at least within the context of our model, politically palatable, okay? Because everybody benefits. UBI, and this is the same mechanism as the increasing transfers to those who are out of the labor force. UBI is, at least, again, within the context of our model, it's terrible. Okay, it's great for some. It's terrible along many dimensions. Because what UBI does is it says, look, no matter what you do, you don't have to be working. You could be unemployed. You can be out of the labor force. You're going to get $6,000 a year. So proportionate to what you're earning, that's really great for the non-participants relative, for instance, to the high skilled. So it really incentivizes non-participation. So you can see that, you know, the move from the pre-automation to the post-automation world, that increased non-participation by a factor of 2. UBI increases it by a factor of 6. So you get a mass flood out of the labor force with UBI. All these people are leaving, and it's really costly. GDP falls. So whereas automation caused GDP to rise by about 12%, essentially you're killing all those benefits by introducing the UBI. And again, how are we financing this UBI? We're taxing the high-skilled. The high-skilled labor tax rate has to increase massively to fund this thing. Okay, so that really disincentivizes work, not only amongst the low-skilled, but also amongst the high-skilled. Who loves it? Non-participants love it. If you're already non-participating and suddenly you get a UBI, you're 34% better. And it also causes a whole bunch of people who were working in low-wage and middle-wage jobs to switch into non-participation. Who hates it? Obviously, the high-skilled, they hate it. Okay. 6 minutes left. Is there a better way to redistribute, you know, the aggregate economic pie? We're going to consider our labor income tax reform. We're going to increase the progressivity of labor income taxes. Okay. What we're going to do is we're going to decrease the average income tax paid by low-skilled workers. These are the middle-class routine workers and the low-wage manual workers. We're going to decrease their income taxes on average by, again, that same number, that $500 per month. And in the model, this essentially means set their income taxes to zero. Okay? So the government revenue is going to fall because you're not taxing the middle and low class anymore. You need to balance budgets, so you've got to increase taxes on the high skill. Again, what you can see is, whereas UBI caused non-participation to rise, making taxes more progressive causes participation, non-participation to fall. In other words, it increases participation. Why? Because I was originally a non-participant. Part of the reason was because, you know, part of my income is going to get taxed. Now you're not taxing me anymore. That increases the return to looking for work, so I enter the labor force. Okay, so you get this rise in the amount of work being done in the routine and the manual occupation. But again, you're taxing the high-skilled more heavily. That disincentivizes them from working. So their labor, you know, the amount of work that they do, that negative two, that's a negative. But, you know, the fact that more routine and manual work is getting done means that on net, there's a very small effect to aggregate GDP. Okay? And relative to UBI, it's a smaller increase in high-skilled taxes, okay, because it's a less costly program. And so what you get is that, you know, this tax experiment where we make taxes more progressive is pretty effective at redistributing income towards the middle and low class. Again, for obvious reasons, the high skill are worse off, but they're not that much worse off, at least relative to something like a UBI program. So it's not too costly to the high skilled. So perhaps this is politically palatable. Whether that statement must be qualified by time and place, obviously. Okay, so again, you know, what we're working on, you know, is a framework, an empirically relevant macroeconomic model of automation that, you know, emphasizes the fact that automation has winners and losers. The reason we're doing this, we think of it as a useful laboratory that we can evaluate various policy proposals that are being discussed. Some are better than others. Again, we think this is useful for, you know, what people are talking about now and what people should be talking about in the future as automation progresses. Okay, so thank you very much.
Thanks, Henry. Gabe?
Thanks very much. Thank you, Henry. Hope you'll excuse my voice. I'm a little under the weather, but I really wanted to be here today with you all. So this is a really great paper. I hope everyone gets a chance to read it. You know, these authors are really leaders in this field. There's nobody else probably on planet Earth that's better to write this paper, and labor search and matching framework is really the right way to go. It allows them both to look at the consequences of automation as well as this kind of rich set of policies that they can really dig deeply into this. So, you know, a lot of macro papers, the kind of policy experiments are not always very credible. That's really not the case here. So I'll talk a little bit about some of the kind of modeling aspects of the paper, and then I'll move on to kind of big picture questions, and I'll suggest some more work for the authors, some new policies they could look at. You know, in terms of the UBI, they find that it's pretty bad. There's been some empirical work on the subject. So if you look at Jones and Marinescu, they look at a UBI-like program in Alaska, and so they find kind of offsetting effects so that the net effect is zero. So they do find this kind of negative labor supply effect that when people have UBI, They are able to work less, and they do find an increase in part-time employment rather than full-time. But overall, the net effect on employment is zero. And we don't know if the part-time employment is people playing video games or if it's mothers taking time to spend with their children or people taking time to go to school. But overall, essentially, there's two factors, and one is modeled in the paper and one is not. One is the negative labor supply effect, but there's also liquidity-constrained households. And so they're going to spend more when they get this UBI, and so they find a kind of offsetting effect where the tradable industries, where demand is not going to be local necessarily, are going to see a big decline in employment, but you're going to see a relatively stable employment level in the non-tradable industries where demand is going to be locally based. So the authors might think about looking at kind of hand-to-mouth consumers to try and think about this effect. So also in terms of taxes, they use a fairly standard framework. So this is not specific to their paper, but in general in macro papers, you're going to find that in general when taxes go up, net wages go down. And so then labor supply is going to fall. So that's essentially a kind of substitution effect that you get that the value of leisure stays the same while the value of work falls. A fairly standard kind of micro econ 101 effect is that you have an income effect too. And so in general, if you look at societies across time, as they get richer, as wages rise, they actually tend to work less because you have an income effect. So people buy both more consumption goods and more leisure. You know, we've talked about Keynes. So obviously he wasn't right about how far hours would fall, but over time, as societies get richer, they tend to actually work less. If you look at richer versus lower income countries, the higher income ones work less. So the Germans work less than the Greeks because Germany has a higher average income per capita. And then as countries grow over time, they tend to work less. This is not specific to this paper at all. This is across kind of all the macro literature back to papers by Prescott and others. But it's kind of strange that we haven't yet really modeled this very simple kind of result. So if you look here over time in the upper left, we have the U.S., and you see hours falling over time. And then here's a sample of some OECD countries. So, Japan, as they've gotten a higher income, they actually work fewer hours than Americans now. And the bottom line here is the Germans. So you might think of France as having low working hours, but actually now Germany has lower working hours. And so I'll talk more about Germany in a second. So in terms of automation, there's this framework in Acemoglu and Restrepo. So they've got to confuse us. There's AR, Acemoglu and Robinson. This is the other AR. So this is a framework to think about automation, and so they think about two kind of effects. There's a displacement effect that the workers directly affected by automation are going to be worse off, and that's kind of the main channel this paper looks at. There's also a productivity effect because automation is going to increase productivity. It raises demand for all products, and so it's going to raise demand for all the other tasks that are not automated. And so it's going to be a kind of race between these two effects. So for automation to be a really big problem, we need that, the displacement effect is going to outweigh the productivity effect. In terms of the current situation, obviously there's some affected workers. In terms of the aggregate, is automation going too fast? Are we seeing some kind of robo-apocalypse, as we heard earlier? I mean, in the aggregate, we actually have somewhat slower productivity growth, and we have kind of record high employment, so it doesn't seem to be a kind of mass problem, but we still can have some problems with specific aspects. And one might be inequality. So the paper doesn't focus specifically all that much on inequality, but implicitly you've got kind of middle-skill workers, kind of middle-class workers, that are being pushed into being low-skill and low wage. And so then that could increase inequality potentially. The authors only have data for a few decades. And it's true that over this time, inequality has risen, but, as an economic historian, this is a fairly small slice of, human history. So if you look, you have different authors that find different increases in inequality. Obviously, Piketty is going to find a much larger increase. Auden and Splinter find a smaller one. But overall, we know the general trend since about 1980 that you've had increasing inequality. So if you look at the period since 1980 and you think about automation, then it looks like, those two things are linked up. If we take a longer span of history, we'd want to think about periods when inequality is falling. Are those periods with slower automation? Some of the terminology in the paper is I find a bit strange because they talk about a pre-automation period. But obviously, we've had automation in things like cotton textiles for a quarter of a millennia at this point. And so you have, you know, from the beginning, some middle-skill workers. These are the Luddites, famous Luddites, who were kind of middle-skill craftsmen, who were weavers. And their jobs were being automated away in the early 19th century. And so they raged against the machine and tried to break these machines because their jobs were being replaced by low-skill textile workers in the Industrial Revolution. And so what's the case here? You know, were they irrational? If we look on the right, you can see Greg Clark's numbers on the ratio of craftsmen to kind of low-skilled wages. And it's true that these people got automated away, and the craftsman skill premium relative to low-skilled workers is going to collapse over the 19th century. So they're going to lose out. But, you know, overall, it takes some time. If you see on the left, you can see when, you know, Engels is writing about the dire conditions in British factories. But eventually, this kind of productivity effect is going to cause gains in wages, and all this demand for low-skilled labor is going to raise living standards. It's a story of modern economic growth and the prosperity that we see today. So, you know, what's going to happen to inequality over this period? Here we can see from Lindard and Williamson. You can focus on the UK, earlier England and Wales. So when the Luddites are destroying the machines, is actually going to be a period when inequality is declining. So it's not inevitable that automation will cause inequality. It's going to depend on, you know, how institutions are set up and, you know, this productivity versus this displacement effect. As they're seeing their kind of middle-class jobs being destroyed, it's creating a huge amount of demand for low-skilled labor, which is going to raise living standards and actually see a decline in inequality from about 1800. Luddites are about a decade after that. The UK inequality is going to fall for almost two centuries after that. So we periodically have these kind of panics about automation. I guess this conference is part of that. But you see it in the Great Depression, too. There's panics about, you know, automation causing the unemployment in the Great Depression. And so then, you know, the idea then was that you have industrial skills and all the farmers just can't hack it with these new skills and industries. And so then once the economy recovers, you get kind of infinite demand during the war, then everybody kind of forgets about this automation fear once unemployment ends. So another kind of thing to think about is that, you know, being routine is not going to be inevitable. So, you know, something like an accountant would have been unimaginable to be routinized. Now it's always kind of a front runner for being routinized away. But, you know, to some extent, we have the institutional framework to think about, too. In the U.S., the tax preparation companies have blocked the government from automatically filling your tax forms. And so, unlike the Luddites, who eventually would lose, the tax preparation companies have been successful at blocking automation. And so the institutional framework is going to matter for how institution matters for economic outcomes. So in terms of alternative policies, I think the UBI comparison is nice. You know, it's kind of topical for thinking about automation. But I think we should consider some other policies. You know, we've got the real wage that's related to productivity, but it's really going to be mediated through these labor market institutions. And so I'd like to consider a case of another country that I think has been more successful with automation, dealing with the kind of social consequences of that. So when we think about Germany, they've got these co-determination institutions that are going to give workers a lot more power to determine how the labor markets function, what's going to happen to jobs when jobs are automated away, and how wages are set within large firms. So we've got things like work councils that are going to have workers advising firms, and then co-determination where workers are going to sit on the boards of large firms. So it's been successful at having relatively higher wages in manufacturing, as we'll see in a few more slides. It hasn't really had adverse impacts on employment. So sometimes people are worried about, you know, will this discourage investment or employment or job openings? Well, Germany has an even lower unemployment rate than the U.S. at about 3.1%. So you've got a lot of automation and capital deepening in Germany. It's a much more manufacturing-heavy economy. And so, you know, if you've got things like higher profits from automation, then because of these labor market institutions, you're going to get higher profits being shared with workers to some extent, kind of standard effect. And also, you don't necessarily get wages falling. So, you know, you've got wage scales that are set. And so then if there's automation, then those wages won't fall. You'll just reallocate workers into other jobs. So I think that this would fit really well, thinking about this kind of collective bargaining in this Nash bargaining framework, this search and matching model, just said that you have a kind of labor aggregate And the firm essentially has to purchase a whole labor aggregate rather than bilaterally bargaining with an individual worker. So they're going to buy the kind of full set of labor that's appropriate for their technology. And then you negotiate the price ahead of time, so the wage is set for any kind of task distribution. And then, you know, once the wage is set, then workers are going to encounter firms, and they're going to set a match. Without bilaterally bargaining, the wage will already be set, and then they'll just form an employment match if the wage is in between the reservation wage and the value of the worker. And so, you know, you get a lot of distortions from these kind of tax and spend policies. Part of the reason for implementing these kind of co-determination institutions after World War II was to avoid the kind of big government or tax and spend policies, to keep kind of free market system, but just strengthening the bargaining power of workers so that then you don't need to have all these distortive policies. So I suspect that considering these kind of co-determination institutions would likely be a relatively favorable policy relative to the others like UBI. So we've got a lot more automation in Germany. This is from the Douth et al. Paper. So if you look at robots per 1,000 workers, it's much higher in the black line in Germany. The U.S. has a lot less per 1,000 workers, and that's because manufacturing is just a much larger share of the economy in Germany. So the U.S. has largely, you know, kind of deindustrialized, and so there's just a lot more robots per worker in Germany. And you see the same kind of effects from automation. So the medium skilled are seeing their jobs destroyed, and it's really in these kind of routine things like a machine operative, so a kind of standard factory worker. So you're seeing the same kind of effects that this paper finds, that you're destroying the kind of middle-skilled jobs, but it's not going to have the same impacts in terms of the social consequences like in the U.S. Rust Belt, where you're seeing high unemployment. So workers are simply moving into different tasks, and overall this paper finds no effect on employment. So essentially firms are no longer hiring new workers. They're just going to move automated workers into different tasks. And so Germany is kind of the leading manufacturing country because despite having less than a third of the population of the U.S., it exports about the same, and a larger share of its exports are in manufacturing. We might want to consider them really as the leading industrial power today rather than the U.S. Because they've kept a higher share of manufacturing. If you look at manufacturing wages, you might say, well, Germany's just doing wage repression. They're able to compete just because they've kept wages low. Well, you're much better off being a manufacturing worker in Germany, so your wages are much higher, about 33% higher. So this kind of profit-sharing mechanism is working. And if you look at inequality, it has gone up a bit in Germany. It's gone up a bit in the U.S., but overall, it still remains a very equitable country. So I would argue that this is a fairly successful model. That would be one kind of policy to consider relative to automation. So overall, I really like this paper. I appreciate the authors would write it, and then I could discuss it. I could be bold and argue that automation is largely a solved problem, that we do have cases of policies that have worked to address automation. It's election season, so you can vote for co-determination if you want. There's some candidates that are looking at that. And hopefully we can provide some better policy frameworks to address the problems with automation going forward. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot, Gabe. Okay, we're going to have some time for we have some time for some questions. I'll probably take two or three initially.
Okay.
And but first, I wanted to make a comment. When Gabe mentioned that this seems like we have this spark in worry about automation, I'm reminded. So one of my guilty pleasures at night before I go to bed is I watch The Twilight Zone, and I've counted 6 episodes over the last 3 seasons that focus specifically, 6 episodes over the last 3 seasons that focus specifically on what robots and automation is going to do to people and society and so on and so forth. So clearly they carried about this around the time my mother was born in the early 60s. Okay, Molly.
Hi there, I'm Molly Kinder. I'm a new David Rubenstein Fellow with the Metro Policy Program. I have 2 questions for Henry. One is, I'd love to unpack a little bit, and I know you had to go pretty fast because of the time, the empirical model where you derive the third to third. My understanding is that I'm assuming your data on the routine work is primarily comprised of the clerical and secretarial work as well as the more production work. And my understanding of looking over the last 30 years of automation experience is that the predominantly female labor force of clerical has had a very different experience than the more male-dominated production work when it comes to this question of labor force participation and whether or not those workers are falling down into low-skilled worker moving up. And the reason why I'm raising this is I'm wondering how you're factoring in your model. Not, you talked about freezing the worker, but in fact, there's a more dynamic experience that was happening with women, which is over those years, they were gaining more human capital and education. So if you look at what happened to women over that time, many of those women moved into higher skilled, high paying jobs because of the human capital formation. So I'd love to just unpack that a little bit and question some of the assumptions given some of those changes. How do we take that into account in your model? And my second point is I just wanted to bring a little bit of a human perspective and a job quality question to your – you had a slide up that talked about why aren't more people taking jobs such as these fast-growing personal care jobs. I just finished this large human-centered research project where I led a team where we interviewed workers in exactly some of these routine jobs and low-skill jobs mm-hmm. that are at the highest risk of automation, so secretaries, administrative assistants, legal assistants, and we asked questions about if you lost your job, what would you do? It's interestingly, many of those workers had previously worked in those female-dominated, care-based social work, child care, personal care aides. For them, moving from a routine administrative job into one of those jobs is a huge fall in the job quality. Those jobs are tiring. A lot of these women are older. They're physically exhausting, running around after kids, lifting people in beds. They're terrible pay. They're horrible hours. And I think this question of what motivates someone to go into some of these jobs, we have to talk about job quality. So I'm wondering in your model, why something like raising the minimum wage or raising the quality of those jobs so that people who may be losing welfare moving into those jobs are not losing welfare so much?
Marcus, can I answer that? There's a lot there that
we'll come back to. Okay. Well, if you want to start,
yeah,
answer it.
You know, my short-term memory is not great, so I want to address your questions as soon as I can. So, okay, yeah. First, with respect to the gender differences in the experience of routine work loss. So, you know, what's interesting, and this gets back to one of the questions that was asked earlier on, is, the male and female experience is very different. So if you look at the typical male routine worker, I think a good characterization would be a production worker on the factory floor, you know, the technology to automate some of their tasks was introduced in the late 60s and the 1970s. That's when industrial, CPU-controlled robotics was introduced. But you don't see their employment losses happening concurrent with that time. It wasn't until the 1982, the back-to-back 1980-1982 recessions, when employment in those occupations were lost during the recession and then they never came back. If you think about secretarial work, bank tellers, that was really automation of those tasks was really enabled by the introduction of the personal computer, which happened in, you know, the mid to late 1970s. But of course, throughout the 1980s, employment in those occupations, and especially amongst women in those occupations, continued to rise through the 1980s. And employment losses in those occupations, the disappearance of those routine jobs, that didn't happen until the 1991 recession, then the 2001 recession, and really now after the financial crisis, Great Recession of 2009. So, as to the business cycle effect and kind of this delayed effect, you know, you've seen it in the past, 30, 40 years. Automation doesn't come necessarily when the technology comes. It's usually delayed, and this automation happens in short, sharp bursts. You know, the losses happen in recessions, and those occupations don't come back. Okay, and in terms of the fact that the female-male experience has been very different, you're exactly right. These routine jobs are amongst men are typically occupations that involve little more than a high school education. Whereas the routine jobs that women were working required some post-secondary education. And what women have done is they've actually moved up the educational ladder to a much greater extent than men have. They've moved up the occupational ladder. They've been able to get the better high-paying jobs. And in other work that, my colleague Nir and Matias Cortes and I have done is we've actually provided what we think is credible evidence that, you know, it's not, you know, technological change and automation doesn't just affect what occupations are getting worked and what occupations aren't anymore. It also changes the nature of work within occupations. And so we have evidence, I think, that shows that there's been an increasing demand for interpersonal and social skills within jobs. You know, I think one of the reasons why bank tellers didn't disappear right away is because the nature of what they did changed. They didn't just, you know, take your money, stamp a receipt and hand it to you, or, you know, or just dole out money. Their work became much more consumer focused than in the past. And so the nature of work can change. The nature of tasks within occupations can change. We have found that it's changed towards more human-based tasks like interpersonal and social skills, and that's one of the factors that have allowed women to better withstand automation than men.
Thanks, Henry. I do want to direct you, if you want to learn more about this topic, in our first conference, we had a paper written by Patricia Cortes and Jessica Pond where they talked about these issues at length and developed some new techniques to actually measure them. So you can check our automation page, the Future Middle Class Initiative page within the automation stream for a copy of that paper from the September 13th conference. Okay, we're going to take a few more questions, then I'll come back to Gabe and Henry.
Yes, ma'am. Grace School, Dracaena Capital. So thank you for the discussion. I find the framework very interesting. The question is for Henry. On the macro policy implications, you highlighted two areas of potentially high potency, training and taxing. So on taxing, have you thought about, you know, we take tax on income as an accepted practice. Have you thought about taxing robots or taxing disruptors?
Okay.
Thank you.
Oh, well first Lawrence, and then you two.
Okay. I'm loud. I'm Larry Michel from the Economic Policy Institute. Appreciate the paper. I want to question whether it's useful to focus on job polarization as anything useful for insights, because I think the main phenomena that needs to be explained is wage inequality and wage stagnation. And we know that changes of occupational composition has had very little to do with anything about wage stagnation or wage inequality. Most of wage inequality is within occupations. And if you want to connect it to the personal skills or something like that, I'm waiting for evidence on that. But I have not seen that. And I think the comment by Molly is exactly right on. You know, the idea of shifting people to routine manual work when it's been even though it's been expanding, but it's very low wage and exploited and without benefits is kind of surprising. One comment on labor share, similar to what Gabriel said, he's presented data on household income inequality, but if you look at actual distribution of wages, the only real significant phenomena within the wages is the near doubling of the share of the top 1%. So I'm not sure, you know, whether this automation is really a salient thing. And last, I find the discussion in this paper, policy, and in the earlier discussion somewhat otherworldly in the sense that if you went back 30 to 35 years to people in this room talking about manufacturing experience and the implosion of manufacturing, you would find they would have said, let's have more productivity, let's have more innovation, and let's educate people. And if you look what happened, manufacturing workers, even there was no evidence that any education or training really helped them all that much. There was not enough given. But what happened was they got shifted to lousier jobs. And so what that brings forward is We're missing the deterioration of the quality of jobs and the deterioration of wages and benefits for most people, and it's surprising to find a discussion now that ignores the crisis of the last 40 years in thinking about the crisis that may be coming.
Okay, let's take two more down here, and then Gabe and Henry can respond.
Martha Ross, a fellow at the at Brookings Metro. So in response to your open question, we currently, I would say, have no capacity, or very, very limited capacity to do the kind of large-scale training that you propose, which is not to say that we don't know how to do it. There are good models. There is knowledge. It is underfunded. We don't have the political will to make the hard choices to allocate funding to where it needs to go or to overcome institutional inertia to get places to do it better or to focus on it. And we don't have the kind of employer involvement that we need. Secondly, I wonder if there's a way to pair what was described earlier as companies with better management practices doing better to pair some kind of business services assistance to help more companies have more efficient, more productive internal processes, along with a focus on helping them derive greater productivity from their workers, which would probably involve some skill development. And lastly, this is a sort of a plea to policy wonks and economists at large. I really think we should stop conflating low skill with low wage, because it is disrespectful. If you look at the work that, just to highlight the care occupations are doing, that is skilled work. It's just skills that are not valued in the labor market.
One more.
Thank you, Dave Rubenowitz. You seem to be, the goal of your policy seems to be increasing labor force participation rather than increasing quality of life of people. And I'm wondering if that's a good idea, because the points just made are basically getting people into these bad jobs is not increasing the quality of their life at all. And as for personal care, in Japan and China right now, they're already employing robots for personal care. It's being tested now in some residence homes in the U.S., and it's coming very soon. Robots have the advantage of not forgetting, not getting sick, and actually enjoying hearing the same story over and over again. Should we be worrying about labor force participation or quality of life? And this is where the rest of Keynes's paper is very relevant, the part that hadn't been quoted yet today.
Okay, so first, taxing robots. Is it useful to focus on job polarization, issues related to management at firms, and quality of life or labor force participation?
Yeah, okay, so those are great questions. So, yes, in terms of taxing robots, that is something that we do consider in the paper. And, yes, you can tax robots. Essentially what advances in automation technology does is it makes it cheaper to buy this automation capital. You tax the purchase of that capital. You could just undo the improvements in technology, and you can just wipe that all away. So in our model, it's a very easy thing to do. The question is whether you want to do it, whether you want to stifle that, whether you want to stifle the economic pie from growing, or do you allow the pie to grow and then just redistribute better. The question about, whether we should be talking about automation or wage inequality, and unfortunately this is a conference on automation, so I have to talk about automation. But I do agree. The wider question about wage inequalities is relevant. I do think that, within the context of our model, which is obviously a very wonkish model, we do have an ability to think about labor market institutions and how the economic pie is split up over and above redistributive policies. Like I said, there's built into the model a wage bargaining process, which depends on the relative bargaining strength of firms and workers. Gabriel pointed out, rather than having bilateral bargaining, you could think about centralized bargaining as done in the German works councils. But, at least within the context of bilateral bargaining, we could think about evolution or changes in the bargaining power of workers versus firms. It's interesting to think that, I think there's an understanding that at least in the U.S. context, these personal care, basic health care occupations are low-paying jobs in the U.S. That's not necessarily the case in Canada, where I'm from. They're still relatively low-paying, but they're not, in absolute terms, the same level of lowness. And I think one of the things that informs that is that our labor market institutions in Canada are different. The union, just as a
simple thing to observe, unionization rates in Canada, even though our industrial composition is very similar across the U.S. and Canada, unionization rates are 2 to 3 times that of the U.S., and that is an example of a labor market institution.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Does that mean you could use your model to increase worker bargaining power and see what effect that had?
Yes, that is a parameter of the model. We have not done that, no.
That would be great to see.
Okay. Yeah, and then in terms of, you know, as Gabriel was talking about, yes, this, the German works councils, you know, again, because Germany's, you know, those works councils exist largely in manufacturing, you know, that's tied into their apprenticeship system. But my understanding is that in Germany, the works council, which represents these machine operators, they are much more involved with the adoption and implementation of automation technology. And that means that, in, like I was saying before, the machine operator occupation has evolved much more in Germany than it has in the U.S. You know, a machine operator in the U.S. is just someone who pushes a button, whereas in Germany, you know, they are training the machine operator also to calibrate the machine and to optimize workflow. So that's another example of evolution of tasks within occupations that, again, differs across labor market institutions as represented by works councils. The U.S.-Canada comparison is perhaps measured by differences in unionization rates. But, yeah, these are things that are worthy of discussion, absolutely.
Gabe, you got anything to add to that?
No, I think that was good. I mean, the apprenticeship system is something I didn't have time for. Oh, thank you. But, you know, it's part of the story. So it's not just a co-determination story. You know, I think there are a lot of lessons, though, from Germany that, you know, we could think about here related to, Larry's point. Yeah, I mean, you know, that was kind of the points I was trying to get across in my discussion.
Speaking to the mic.
Okay. what I was trying to get into in my discussion was that, you know, it is really conditional on these labor market institutions. So in terms of the modeling, you know, thinking about that deeper, I think, is useful.
Okay. One last question. Anybody have anything? Okay. So I want to thank Henry for his interesting paper and Gabe for his fantastic discussion. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back for a paper on unions.
It is a very quick break, everybody, just 10 minutes.
Yeah. Okay, everyone, we're about to get started again. Okay. Zach, whenever you want to take it away.
Sure.
They'll shut up.
I'll give 5 seconds for the gentleman in the back to find their seats, and then we'll get started. All right. Hello, everyone. First, I want to say thanks to the Brookings team for coordinating this event today and for inviting us to be here to speak. My name is Zach Perlin. I'm at the Center on Poverty and Social Policy at Columbia University. And the focus of my research and the presentation today, as you can see on the screen, is trying to understand the role of organized labor, worker power in general, in shaping the employment and earnings trajectories of workers who are in routine occupations. And I'll be testing some, showing some results using the PSID, which is a source of panel data that follows individual workers in the U.S. over time through about a 3-decade period. So the nice thing about a conference like this is that I don't need to spend much time on background, but I'll just say a couple words about this idea of routine bias technological change, or this idea that technological advancements generate declining demand for routine tasks. And we know from our conversation this morning, from plenty of prior research on this topic, that routine bias technological change can generate a couple types of consequences. The first relates to employment shares. So for these occupations that are more routine in nature, your manufacturers, your office clerks, and so forth, we've seen over the last few decades a decline in their employment shares relative to other types of occupations. Again, we know from discussion this morning that these occupations tend to be in the middle of the wage and earnings distribution. So when their employment shares fall, if the employment shares of lower pay and higher pay jobs increase, we have what's called job polarization. Employment shares are one thing, but we could also look at occupational wages or even annual earnings. We know that there's a possibility that due to declining demand for routine tasks, that workers in these occupations will experience perhaps declining relative wage growth over time. But what I want to emphasize is that if you actually look across states in the U.S., if you look across other high-income countries, this is not a universal trend. And even in the U.S., you can read Larry Michel's work on this, it's perhaps confined to one decade at a particular point in time in this country. So what I'm going to focus on and the questions that I think we need more research on in general relate to what you see on the screen right here. That so often when we assess the consequences of technological change, we do so from a very macro-level perspective, looking at changes in the aggregate to see how employment shares of certain types of occupations change over time, but perhaps not enough focus on the experiences of individual workers. A couple of exceptions that I'll talk about, but you can think about why this might be important. If you are in this routine job, your job is made redundant due to technological change, what does it mean? To what types of occupations are you moving to? Are you more likely to live in poverty? Are you sent to unemployment? What is that experience like? And using panel data, we can try to answer some of those questions. And the reason we're here today is because there's a need for more research on the role of labor market institutions in shaping variance in earnings and employment opportunities of these occupations at greater risk of automation. Labor market institutions, a broad category. We could talk about, you know, minimum wages. We could talk about a number of things. But I'm going to focus on worker power and the role of organized labor in the form of trade unions in particular. I want to again highlight a couple of the advantages of using panel data to follow individual workers over time and what this might be able to add to our conversation. First, we can answer this question of where are the workers going? Is it true that if you're in a routine job, your job is made redundant, that you're more likely to move to a lower pay service sector type job? Or perhaps might you move to a higher paid job? Are you sent to unemployment? What does that process actually look like on average? How do these individuals fare when their job is made redundant? Again, are they stuck in unemployment? Are they more likely to live in poverty? And then is this conditional on certain policy choices that we make? And then we can also get at some of the mechanisms that sit beneath these macro-level changes. So if we see a decline in the share of routine jobs, is this because there's accelerated layoffs of these individuals in the jobs, or is it just a slowdown in hiring that occurs over time? Using this individual-level data, we can start or do more, perhaps, to answer those questions. I mentioned there's a couple papers and probably more that are using panel data already to answer these types of questions. In the British case, Thomas Kerr and Anna Gallego find that about 64% of British workers in routine jobs remain in that routine occupation 5 years later. A pretty small group is switching out. And in their study, they actually find very few are unemployed 5 years later. Interestingly, they find that most individuals who transition out of routine jobs are not moving to service sector, lower paid jobs, but are in fact moving to higher pay or at least higher status jobs. And Matias Cortez finds something similar, that high-ability workers are more likely to switch out of routine jobs and tend to fare better over time if they do. What I'm going to add to this, hopefully, is a focus on labor market institutions, a focus on worker power and how that shapes the employment trajectories of these types of individuals. Why focus on organized labor? I think many of you are probably familiar with this literature, but if not, there's plenty of evidence that greater union coverage or greater collective bargaining coverage in cross-national comparison is associated with lower levels of in-work poverty rates, more compressed wage distribution, more employment security for individuals in precarious jobs, higher wage premiums for workers in routine occupations. I've shown in work for the OECD that union membership is beneficial for the relative earnings growth of routine occupations. And we know that unionization is on the decline here in the U.S., but that is not a universal trend, particularly when we look at collective bargaining coverage and look at other high-income countries. And I can talk about that more later if desired. So here are the precise questions that I'm going to try to answer over the next half hour or so. First, I'm going to look at employment tenures and transitions of workers in routine occupations. So where do these individuals in routine occupations, where do they go if they leave their routine job? Is it the case that unionized routine workers are more likely to maintain their jobs for a longer duration of time relative to non-unionized routine workers? In other words, can unionization help sort of slow that transition process into this labor market of the future? And then I'm going to look at, are unionized routine workers less likely to become jobless in general relative to the non-unionized group? So then I'll switch to earnings. That's the employment focus. So we can look at earnings. Is it the case that unionized routine workers experience higher earnings while they're in their routine jobs relative to non-unionized routine workers and relative to former routine work individuals in routine occupations who have switched to other types of jobs? Okay? To answer these questions, I'm going to use microdata from what's called the Panel Study of Income Dynamics, or the PSID. This is panel data that follows the same individuals over about a three-decade period, 18,000 individuals in the sample. I'm primarily focusing on outcomes from 1980 onward for data consistency purposes, and I'll be looking at adults between the ages of around 25 to 64. Anyone who's worked in a routine occupation throughout their career is included in the sample, and I'll be looking at their transitions and earnings trajectories. We've talked a little bit about how we can categorize different occupations in the earlier presentations, and I'm going to use a very similar classification to what Henry and others have used. It's these three that you see here on the screen. So we have these non-routine cognitive occupations, which tend to be more of your managerial, professional-level occupations. In the middle, we have the routine occupations, again, your office clerks, customer service clerks, trade workers, manufacturing, etc. And at the very bottom, we have the non-routine manual group. Tends to be more service sector, healthcare type occupations. And on this side over here, I've just simply laid out an indicator of low earnings. This is if your earnings, annual earnings, are below 50% of the national median. And you can see the share that has low earnings by group. It's exactly what you would expect. So among these non-routine cognitive jobs, only 6% with low earnings from 2013 to 2015. Among the routine occupations, about 14%, and among the non-routine manual, about 21%. So it's what you'd expect, and I'm going to use this benchmark of low earnings throughout the rest of this presentation as well. So how am I going to answer those questions that I put to you before? A couple different approaches. I'm going to try to do as much work as possible with just descriptive data. So looking at the different employment and earnings outcomes for adults who are unionized versus non-unionized at different intervals after they were first in that routine job. So, for example, I'll look 2 years after they were in that first entered the routine job, see how they're doing, 4 years later, 6 years later, 8 years later, and 10 years later. And at each time interval, try to get some assessment of the role of unionization in shaping the likelihood that they're still in a routine job, if they switch to another type of occupation, their earning status, and so on. Then I'll use individual fixed effects models. So taking advantage of the fact that we have data on individual workers over time, we can try to weed out some of these between worker differences and take advantage of the fact that many individuals, when they start their routine jobs, are not unionized, but perhaps become unionized during that employment process. And if that's the case, do we see on average that contributes to different earnings and employment outcomes? And finally, those who know the union wage premium literature know that selection effects are always a massive challenge. I'm going to try to address for selection effects using propensity score weighting techniques, but of course, it's not a perfect fix. But I'll talk about that more in a little bit. Quickly, for those who prefer equations, this is very simple. Our outcome variable here is simply the occupation type at 2, 4, 6, 8, and 10 years later. I'll estimate these separately. So are you still in routine work? Are you in a non-routine cognitive job, non-routine manual, unemployed, low earnings? Controlling for things like age, sex, education, race, ethnicity, year dummies, and state dummies. And when we move to the individual fixed effects model, it looks almost identical, but of course, adding these person-level fixed effects and treating unionization as a permanent treatment here. So in this model, if you became unionized at all during routine work, count you as a unionized individual and look at your employment and earnings outcomes even if later on you leave your job or leave your union. And again, I'll take some steps to try to account for selection effects based on observables, talk about this more in the paper, and I'll show you what happens when we do that, but recognizing that it's not a perfect fix to selection problems. So if we get into the results, first, just some very basic descriptive stuff. We're going to look at employment shares of all employed adults and union membership as told by the PSID data from 1981 to 2015. And so if you see the very top line there, the triangles, that's your non-routine cognitive jobs. You know, more of these professional and managerial type occupations. You can see a slight increase over time from around 50% to, say, 55% in this sample. The line in the middle with the X's, that's your routine occupations. And as we know, a slight decline over time, not massive, but from about 40% closer to 30% from 1980 to 2015. Union membership is the very light-colored line, third from the top. Again, consistent with what we already know from past work, there's a decline in union membership. It does show up here in the PSID sample from about 25% to closer to 15%. And the very bottom line are these non-routine manual occupations, more of the service sector type jobs. And again, you see a rise in their employment shares over time. So consistent with what we know from past work. But now let's get to the more exciting stuff. What happens to the individuals who are in routine jobs? We'll start with 10 years later. Where do they end up? And does this vary based on whether they were unionized while in routine work during those 10 years, at least one of the 10 years, versus not? And so the line I want to highlight first is this dark gray line that sticks out for both groups. This is the unconditional mean, so not controlling for age, sex, education, anything yet. But this is the share that is still in a routine occupation 10 years later. And for this unionized group, it's about 72% on average, fairly high. For the non-unionized group, you can see it's about 46%. Now, there's a lot of things that could be explaining this. We'll get into that. But if you just look at the unconditional means, you see there is some difference between the group that was unionized versus not. If you look at the first bar, it's the black bar here. This is non-routine cognitive jobs. Again, these more professional and managerial type occupations. For the unionized group, only about 15% of this group was in a non-routine cognitive job 10 years later. In contrast, the non-unionized group, about 30%. So of that non-unionized population, most of them, the largest chunk of them, if they're transitioning jobs, they are moving to what are generally higher pay type occupations, but that's also true for the unionized group. In fact, this bar here, the third one, is the non-routine manual. This is more of your service sector type occupations. No difference between the two groups, about 5% each. And the last bar, it's hard to see on the screen, but this is unemployment. And what you see, this says 9% over here for the unionized group, 20% for the non-unionized group. So for individuals who were unionized during their spell of routine employment, 10 years later, only about half as likely to be jobless compared to the non-unionized group. This includes data that spans, you know, 1980 to 2015. So you might be wondering, well, you know, is this all about the 1980s or the 1990s? Does this still apply? So I'm not going to focus much on this slide, but what I want to show you is that in the paper, I do segment this by decade. And across decades, you see somewhat similar pattern, that the unionized group tends to stay in the routine jobs longer relative to the non-unionized group, less likely to be unemployed 10 years later, regardless of which decade you're looking at. So what happens when we start to bring some controls into the model? Now we add age, education, sex, race, ethnicity, year of observation, state of residence, and we can look at the conditional effect now of union membership on the likelihood of employment and earnings outcomes at 2, 4, 6, 8, and 10 years after they first enter that routine job. Okay, so on the x-axis for each of these, you have 2, 4, 6, 8, and 10. That's years after they were first observed in that routine occupation. So if we narrow in on the upper middle panel, this is the conditional effect of unionization on the likelihood of remaining in a routine job at these different time intervals. And you can see it's positive and statistically significant, suggesting that union membership, again, is associated with a greater likelihood of remaining in these routine jobs, similar to what I've shown you before. And this is consistent at 2, 4, 6, 8, and 10 years afterwards. At 10 years, it's about a 15 percentage point increase in the likelihood that you're still in that job relative to the non-unionized group. So where are these other individuals going again? This is what we saw before. Union membership is associated with a decreased likelihood of transitioning into a non-routine cognitive job, which again are more of your professional and managerial type occupations. That's shown here, consistent with what I showed you in the last slide. What I find interesting are these bottom two indicators, unemployment and low earnings. So union membership is associated consistently with a decreased likelihood of being jobless 2 years later, 4 years later, 6 years later, up to 10 years later, about a 5 percentage point decrease in the likelihood of being jobless. And if we look at low earnings, again, this is consistently negative, indicating that union membership decreases the likelihood that you are going to have annual earnings that are below 50% of the median. And this only includes employed adults. The unemployed are not included in this calculation. I want to show you some more just descriptive statistics on the demographics of these occupation types 10 years after they were first in these routine jobs. And this highlighted group here is the routine unionized group, and we're going to compare some characteristics of them to these other types of groups. Starting with just overall occupation shares, employment shares, you can see that the routine unionized group is pretty small. It's about 11%. We know that this group is traditionally smaller. Individuals in this group are more likely to hang on to their jobs over time, but as a whole, they're about 11% on average 10 years after first entry into routine work. This column, it might be hard to read, it's cut off, but it's the share with low earnings, or earnings below 50% of the median. And what stands out to me is for the unionized routine group, it's only about 3% of those individuals who have low earnings 10 years later, and that's lower than any other occupation category on here. So if you look at non-unionized routine, it's about 11%. Even if you go up to the non-routine cognitive jobs, you can split them out into their sub-occupations, 3%, 7%, 5%, all higher than this unionized routine group. And, of course, you know, these more service sector type jobs at the bottom, about 20% for individuals who moved into these occupations are experienced low earnings. Not much difference in terms of the age of these routine unionized workers, but there are some differences in education levels. And in particular, what this shows is that this group is much less likely to have a college degree, much more likely to only have a high school degree. So when we think about pathways to the middle class for individuals without a college degree, this is more evidence of decades worth of evidence that union membership might be important, particularly combined with what are, at least used to be, these middle pay type occupations. What happens when we look at percent male and percent white, or percent female? You can see this also happens to be a very male group. About 2/3 of this group is men, only 1/3 women, and a bit more racially diverse than the non-routine cognitive occupations, but comparable to the non-routine manual group. So do these findings hold when we move to the individual fixed effects models? So now, again, we're looking at within-person changes over time. On average, if you started routine work non-unionized, but you flipped to unionization, does this have some effect on your outcomes? And the short answer is yes. Everything I'm going to show you here is consistent with what I've shown you in the prior slides. So the effect of union membership on the likelihood of remaining in routine work for the 20 years after you're first in that routine job, it's about an 18 percentage point increase relative to the not being unionized. Decreased likelihood that you move to a non-routine cognitive job, again, exactly what I've shown you before. Decreased likelihood of experiencing unemployment during the 20 years after you were first in that routine job, about a 5 percentage point reduction, and a reduction in the likelihood that you experience low earnings. If we try to account for selection into unionization, maybe these people who become unionized have certain characteristics that just fundamentally make them different than the non-unionized group. That could be driving our outcomes. So one way to try to get around this is using propensity score reweighting techniques. In the paper, I don't show it here, you can see that this does a pretty effective job of achieving balance between the comparison and the treatment group at baseline, but it's not perfect. But what happens when we try to account for selection? Well, you see the point estimates drop a little bit by about 1/4, but still fairly large and significant. So now instead of a 18 percentage point increase, union membership is associated with a 13 percentage point increase in the likelihood of staying in that routine job for a longer duration of time. And similar stuff, unemployment and low earnings still at about 5 and 4 percentage point reductions, respectively. In the paper, I break this up by decade. I break it up by race, ethnicity, education levels, etc. I'm not going to spend time talking about these results, but what you generally see is that the patterns are consistent across time, across education group, race, ethnicity, and sex as well. And that's discussed more in the paper if you're interested. And there's another way to visualize some of this, just using an event study specification type framework. Here, looking at the effect of union membership during routine work on employment and earnings relative to all other adults in routine work. This red line here at zero is the point of unionization. So before, you can see that the treatment group didn't have different likelihood of having low earnings or to be unemployed. But after unionization, you see some pretty clear negative effects consistent with everything I've showed you in the prior slides. So some conclusions, some takeaways from this work. First, I find it interesting that individuals in routine occupations who leave their routine jobs typically are moving to non-routine cognitive jobs, not necessarily these non-routine manual jobs. In other words, they're often moving towards these sort of light professional or light managerial type occupations rather than lower pay service sector jobs, which is perhaps a positive outcome because those occupations in the non-routine cognitive world tend to pay better than the routine jobs and especially the non-routine manual jobs. Very few are moving downwards to service sector jobs. The only reason I say downward is because they tend to be lower pay, and this is consistent with some prior work as well. The second point here, we see evidence that individuals in routine jobs who are unionized tend to remain in their routine occupations for a longer duration of time. So it seems that unions have some mitigation effect on the pace of employment transitions when new technologies are introduced. This unionized group tends to earn higher wages relative to the non-unionized group, and they tend to be less likely to have low earnings or earnings that are below 50% of the annual median. And this third point sort of summarizes it, that organized labor seems to play a pretty important role in shaping the pace and consequences of technological change. And I want to emphasize this point for a moment, because I think so often when we talk about automation or technological change or globalization, we perceive it as these large, scary, exogenous, inevitable forces that are going to inflict some type of pain on certain members of society and that there's nothing we can do about it. But what I want to emphasize is that that's not necessarily the case. Worker power is one example, as I've tried to show here. But also we can talk about welfare state institutions. We can point to other countries that perhaps do a better job of making sure when you lose your job, you still have some basic level of subsistence until you get back on track. And all of these are policy choices. So to summarize, I think there's a role for policy. I think there's a role for politics, and I think there is a role for worker power when we talk about the social consequences of technological change. Now, we don't have some magic pill or magic wand to revive unions across the U.S. That's going to be a pretty tough job. But what we know is that union membership is not the only strategy for enhancing worker power. There's other strategies that exist. We could talk about sectoral-level bargaining, as exists in many other high-income countries. We could talk about antitrust enforcement. We could talk about worker representation, wage boards. And Gabriel was talking about this earlier in his Germany example. There are other countries that have been more successful in enhancing worker power, institutionalizing that, and not surprisingly, we see different types of outcomes in those countries. So all of these are within the realm of possible. And finally, my last slide here, there's still some things that are unclear or that need more work. So it's not clear, at least in what I presented, if organized labor is slowing down the introductions of new technologies, and that's why they're more resistant? Or is it they're welcoming these new technologies, but they're managing the introduction in a way that avoids layoffs and labor substitution? What are the actual mechanisms behind this relationship? I think that's not clear in my paper, and more work needs to be done on that. And moving forward, of course, there's plenty of work that can be done in this paper, and I welcome ideas on how to strengthen identification to make a more convincing case for the causal effect of union membership, or at least to test it. More attention to heterogeneous effects by race, ethnicity, gender, and so forth. And I welcome any other ideas on how to improve upon this work. So thank you all. Should I sit here?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
I've seen what happens when people try. Okay, does that work? You can hear me? Okay. I need to have my hands available for the presentation. So, thanks to Marcus for the opportunity to read this paper and to Zach for writing it. So I'm just going to start, having seen the discussion this morning, I'm glad that I made this figure. So just to remind us what's been going on with union membership in the United States, probably many of us know this, but it's been declining a lot and by about half since 1983. And actually, this is a continuation of a longer-term trend since about 1950. But particularly the private sector unionization is really very low. So a little bit more workers would be sort of covered by a sectoral bargaining agreement, or by a collective bargaining agreement. But you know, unions have really declined over the years. So let me talk now about what this paper is doing. So he's focusing on the experience of workers in routine occupations that have been identified as particularly likely to disappear with automation, and really he's asking, using the data from the PSID, which follows workers over time, so this nice data work, to ask what are the trajectories of union and non-union workers in these routine occupations. And so basically he's asking, what are these workers doing 2, 4, 6, 10 years after entering a routine occupation? And you know, this is with the background of asking whether unions might slow the pace of displacement in these automation-prone occupations. So Zach did a really nice job of summarizing the findings in a clear way, so I won't spend a lot of time on this, but just to recap, union workers are more likely to remain in routine occupations over time. They're less likely to be in non-routine cognitive occupations. They're less likely to be non-employed, and they're less likely to have below median income. So this raises sort of the question of whether these are better outcomes or worse outcomes. So, you know, transitioning to a non-routine cognitive occupation, like, we might generally consider that to be a good outcome. So that's, you know, maybe moving into a professional occupation or something like that. And staying in a routine occupation is stable, but maybe that's, you know, not a great trajectory. But I think it's pretty clear that having low income is bad. And, you know, being unemployed in the sense of trying to find a job and you can't find one is a bad outcome. But being non-employed, potentially being out of the labor force, is less clear whether that's a bad outcome. I think we can cover the sins of economists, and, you know, one is ignoring the value of things that people do when they're not working. And we can make a judgment about video games and raising children, but they perhaps have some value. So I think that the version I read it's not clear whether the effect on low income is driven by non-employment or not, because if you're not employed, if you have low wages. So just to sort that out a little bit, that could shed some light on that. But I think, you know, this paper presents a lot of findings consistent with, you know, what we've seen in other work, that union jobs, you know, are good jobs. They're more stable, and they're higher paying. And so, you know, this is consistent with that. And I think, you know, it would be worth kind of getting at this non-employment angle, and I'm going to return to this in a minute, but I think that is a clear finding of the work. So a few caveats about the paper and potential extensions or areas where he could emphasize more. So, you know, in doing this type of work and trying to understand what's the effect of being in a union on these various outcomes, we're going to worry about whether there are difference between union and non-union workers. And I take the point earlier that maybe we shouldn't call this skill, but there could be differences in these workers and, you know, sort of their the tasks that they're doing and whether those are, let's say, well remunerated by the market. And, you know, he's controlling for age, education, sex, race, state, and year. And so education would be sort of your main doing the main work of kind of thinking about this selection on what tasks or skills tasks people are doing or skills they have. That might be pretty blunt in this context. So I think he could potentially include some other controls related to the occupations that people are doing in unionized and non-unionized. And also sort of related to this, and to the possibility that unionized and non-unionized workers are doing different things or have different skills they're bringing to the labor market, and also to non-participation, I think it would be really nice to divide the analysis by gender and not just control for gender. One, because, and primarily because I think it is really important, this has come up a few times this morning, that women and women's experiences and men's experiences in the labor market are very different. Their trajectories are very different. And I'm not sure it's sort of can be handled by a gender control as opposed to doing a separate analysis. So I think we'll get a more reliable kind of picture if we do that. But I also think it's just very interesting because we know that men and women are doing different work and have different patterns of labor force participation. So this is just one way of seeing that. So I'll admit that I didn't want to deal with the occupation codes. But you can kind of get an idea that men and women who are in private sector unions are doing really different work. So, and also, I don't have it here, but the unionization rate for women is also quite a bit lower, and it's lower conditional on industry. So there are, you know, a lot of differences by gender. So so these are the industries, the top industries that men and women union workers are in. And so you can see that, oh, I can't point, but the biggest group for women is professional services, and like half of that is hospitals. And then for men, you have manufacturing, transportation, communication, public utilities, and construction. So I think just, and you know, having heard the discussion this morning, I think we think about this as a male thing, and that, you know, we're thinking about manufacturing and these kinds of things, and it's important not just for this paper but in general to be really looking at the gender differences, and then the labor force participation patterns are also going to differ a lot. And so I worry a little bit that that could be playing into the findings he has looking at non-employment. Okay, so thoughts on overall on the paper. So I think. You know, the question is, will unions slow displacement in the face of automation? It seems like maybe a little bit, at least, you know, at the level of the individual workers, those jobs are more stable, they're less likely to get displaced. And so then we need to kind of think about, well, what are the costs and benefits of that? Like, is that a good thing? And, you know, normally one of the things we think about when we think about unions is, well, maybe they raise wages of incumbent workers at the expense of potential new entrants. Now, in this case, that's a little bit less of a concern, because if you have an occupation or an industry that where labor demand is declining because of automation, then, you know, maybe this is a way that we kind of protect the incumbent workers' transition, but we don't really care so much that new workers aren't coming into that, you know, to that occupation or that industry, because it's kind of, you know, over time being being displaced by automation. And I think, you know, a really important thing to think about for this paper and in general is this question of, you know, do we want to be preventing displacement, or do we want to be helping displaced workers? And, you know, again, while we're doing economist mea culpas, I think, you know, as a discipline, we have focused a lot on this idea that, well, let's let the creative destruction happen, and technological change will happen, and we shouldn't interfere with that process, and then let's have policies that sort of deal with the consequences and, you know, provide income support for I'm an education economist, so not students, for workers who sort of lose out in that process. And I think, you know, one of the things we're learning that, you know, maybe lots of other people already knew, is that the cost of displacement sort of go beyond beyond the income loss, and you know, so maybe that argues for in favor of sort of supporting approaches that would actually delay displacement as opposed to just dealing with the consequences of that. Now, I think, though, you know, these aren't mutually exclusive, and, you know, my view is we need to be doing a lot more to deal with the consequences, because, you know, it's happening and there's always displacement that happens in the economy. So the question, which I think you got at the end, is, like, well, what role can unions have in, you know, sort of dealing with the consequences of automation? And, you know, at first I was like, well, you know, unions, what, we don't even really hardly have them anymore, so the role, that it can't be, you know, it can't be a huge role. But I think, you know, I guess it just depends on whether you think that that trend can be reversed, which, you know, I don't really have, it seems difficult. But I think that would also be very good for a number of other reasons. And, you know, the fact that the rate is so low suggests that if you were able to bring it back up, you know, maybe there would be some benefits there. And I think those do actually go beyond the effects on displacement in the face of automation. But there's a broader set of potential benefits for middle and working classes that would be associated with that. And I had another point that I thought I wouldn't have time for, but hearing the earlier discussion, and I have 3 minutes, I think another thing the paper raises and Zach's presentation really brought up is we should really be thinking about institutions more broadly. So, you know, this paper is looking at union membership, and I think in the paper you could do an even clearer job of saying, it's like, well, we don't know that these are the effects of union membership per se, but there may be other institutions around or sort of other things related to union membership that matter. And then just in the policy discussion, we can think about these other kinds of, you know, in labor market institutional features like minimum wage and sectoral bargaining and kind of other things that that might have similar types of effects as union membership per se. Thanks.
Okay, thanks, Sarah. So we're going to take some questions, and but I first want to get my question in. Actually, Sarah's last point was actually my first question for you, is the idea of what does unionization really represent? It represents some set of institutions, and so can we think of different ways in a world where unionization itself is seen as kind of, in many respects, passe in some quarters. You know, can we replicate some of the really nice features of unionization if we think institutions matter for some of these things? So that's my first question, and I'm going to go around the room, take about two or three questions, come back to Zach and Sarah, and then I think we'll have enough time for a couple of rounds here. So you first, sir, and then...
I think I'd like to elaborate perhaps on your question a bit further. Is there a way to segment unions between those unions who are essentially, you know, negotiating wage pensions and maybe those which are engineering or craft-based and are actually asking for skills upgrades of their workers, which I think Germany does? I go back to Adam Smith, who actually said that lifelong education was more important for the factory worker so that life was spent not just doing menial things the whole time. And, you know, at the end of the day, there's so much work to be done to develop communities, to develop families, all the things that economists don't sometimes count, but... otherwise, it's self-fulfilling, because if all the unions are only just negotiating wages and pensions, then we're not, being able to look at the second type, which is maybe what is needed.
Right. Okay, Jim.
And then you, sir. And then Richard.
Yeah, Jim.
So this is a comment rather than a question, and it probably applies to the previous discussion also. We need to be a little bit careful about identifying changes in jobs for routine workers with automation, that there are other things that affect those jobs. For instance, people bring up the secretaries and typists being automated away. If you look at technical studies, automation only reduces the amount of retyping that takes place by about 20%. It doesn't explain what happened. What really happened was a shift of job of work from typists to managers and professionals. Similarly, the travel agent wasn't automated away. It was a shift of work to the consumer. So, when we think about unions or when we think about macroeconomic policies, we need to think about the other things that are going on and affecting routine workers aside from just technology.
Henry Hetker, I'm retired government, and I wondered what your feelings were on the closure of the Lordstown, Ohio GM plant. I had contacted a senator from my state in Virginia in the hopes that it could be continued to remain open and to redesign the Impala and the Cruze into electric vehicles or into hybrid vehicles that would permit the thing to stay open because of the new type of vehicle. Somehow, I think there's a lack of imagination on the part of a lot of management in these top companies in as far as job redesign, product redesign, as opposed to simply introducing automation as a way of redesigning a plant. They are going to build electric vehicles there now, but it'll be another company as electric pickup trucks. So it's not a total disaster, but for the unions of GM that were working there, it is quite a disaster, something that probably could have been prevented if people had stepped in and tried to, you know, take up the bat and try to turn things around.
Okay, let's go. Richard.
A clarification before a question, because the question will be redundant if I misunderstood this, Zach. But I think your estimates show that not only is being a union member associated with a lower chance of becoming non-employed, but also a lower chance of moving into a non-routine cognitive occupation, if I read
That's
the
right. Yep.
chart correctly. So if I, using the terms loosely, downward and upward mobility, right, with all the caveats that apply to that, suggests that unions reduce the risk of downward mobility, but also reduce the chances of upward mobility. It's not clear on its face that that's necessarily a win. It may well be that more flexibility and more dynamism is quotes, forcing more people to move on and therefore up rather than remaining in place. You know, the assumption that stasis is good rather depends on the counterfactual. So just love your commentary on the lack of, quotes, upward mobility that you also find among union members.
Yeah,
Yeah, actually, just a direct reaction to that. I think that's in part also a problem of the unions in the U.S. of having a sort of very keeping a status quo and not really looking forward. But that's besides the point. I had one question and one comment and maybe a suggestion for an inclusion in your research. So one thing that I noticed was you broke it down into different decades, and I was wondering whether the data that you were using also permitted a breakdown according to different sectors and more than just a decade, because what I think would be interesting is to see how jobs developed through different sectors, specifically the service industry versus the manufacturing industry, and in particular the effects during the crisis of 2007-2008. Because what would be interesting, and I'm not sure if it's possible, but with some data, for example, from the Metropolitan Statistical Analysis data from the census suggests is that manufacturing industries have been a lot more stable in terms of employment and in terms of incomes, over the years of the crisis. So that would be interesting. I'm not sure if that's possible. But overall, I think the research that you presented is really interesting. I think, in fact, you should turn it into the AFL-CIO. They could use some evidence-based research. But I think if I were to play devil's advocate here and take the position of a company, I would say, well, that's really interesting and that's great. But, you know, unions have a negative effect on companies, right? That's what they will claim always. So I think what would be an interesting addition to your research to omit that would be, and I'm not sure, this is just a suggestion out of the blue, I'm not sure if it's possible with data, maybe not with that data set that you're using, but maybe it's possible with different data sets, to see whether the unionization actually has an effect on companies and on their economic development. Because if it doesn't, then there really isn't any reason why unions could be or should be bashed in the U.S. if they, in fact, have a positive effect on workers, on purchasing power long-term, and on basically a stronger middle class.
Let's see if this robot works. So my name's Carl Polzer, and we're supposed to identify ourselves. I have a small project called the Center on Capital and Social Equity, study inequality, advocate for the bottom half, don't care too much about the top 1%. So my question is kind of a follow-on to Richard's. So I understand the time frame of your study is 10 years. So what if you looked a little further, and this has to do with the paradox of, yeah, well, here's the idea. Maybe the short-term benefits of union membership, you know, pay off in 10 years and keep people in unions. But if non-union members have more of an incentive to retrain, so are there, if you look out further, you know, so they might be doing better off over time, you know, because they got a professional job or they were forced out of a defunct profession. Like my grandfather's Austrian, not Schumpeter. He was a typesetter, and he was a refugee during World War II. So I've seen his union booklets. If he died before computers came in, but if he had been a typesetter in the 70s, he might have kept being a typesetter if he was a young man. And then the computers came in and wiped out the whole back shop of newspapers. So if he had an incentive to change, and, you know, he was very intelligent, he could have, anyhow, blah, blah, blah. But that's the kind of thing. If you look further into the future, you might see the non-union members doing better because they had to adapt, or just an idea to research.
Okay, so we have comments on institutions, you know, whether we should be not just focused, unions shouldn't be focused on just wages and pensions. We have comments on management and how management can potentially mitigate some of the harms associated with plant closures. Richard's question on upper mobility and questions. If I guess the way I take that question is that unions compress the wage distribution, and also mobility from the way we typically measure it. And is that necessarily a win? And that actually plays into this gentleman's question about dynamism And then Yasmin's question about
sectors,
right? Sectoral differences, yep. And you can address our comment as well.
You should.
Okay, thanks a lot. A lot of questions. I'll try to get to all of them, or at least the ones that I'm capable of answering. Start with the first question: can we replicate the role of unions through other mechanisms? We know that we're probably not going to see some great turnaround in union membership anytime soon, but can we sort of replicate their effect in other ways? And the short answer is yes, because many other countries are doing that right now. And I'll point to some examples. You look at a country like France, very low levels of unionization there, but high levels of collective bargaining coverage. Many other countries in Europe have the exact same features. If we were to move towards some system of sectoral level bargaining, then it's not union membership that matters per se, but the fact that the extensions of these union agreements reach everyone who's working in this particular sector, in this particular geographic area. And that's another way to extend what unions provide for workers who are covered, that sense of worker power and some decent, some general standards for labor protections and the earnings distribution. I'll go to Richard's question about upward mobility. Please.
Yes. Can I? Is that because you think it's politically, it seems to me a political issue, both of these, right? So, like, you think it's politically easier to get the kind of policy that extends, you know, coverage to a broader set of workers than it is to revive unions?
Yeah, I think so. That's part of it. It's politically easier, and from a collective organization perspective, it's a little bit easier as well. So unionization in this country and the efforts to revive it are difficult for a number of reasons. We have firms that are very hostile towards collections of workers who try to organize. EPI had a statistic yesterday in a new report showing that employers are charged with violating federal labor law in about 42% of all union drives. I mean, firms are very hostile to efforts to unionize in this country, and I don't know how we're going to overcome that other than through some large policy changes like a move towards sectoral bargaining. Is my general sense around it, but I'm open to counter perspectives. To the idea that unions sort of promote this stasis, they don't allow for individuals, or what we see in the data is that if you're unionized, you're less likely to move into one of these like professional managerial type occupations. But what I would emphasize is that when we look at the share of workers who have low earnings within this unionized group, it's actually lower than individuals who moved into those other occupations. Now, if you look at mean incomes, maybe it's a different story. People in these professional jobs might earn more. But for those of us who are perhaps more concerned with life in the bottom half of the distribution, just ensuring that they have some decent earnings in place, you see that unionized group does pretty well, in fact, better than all the other occupation types 10 years later. So, you know, from a sort of occupational status perspective, perhaps, yes, you know, it's limiting upward mobility. But from a financial well-being perspective, I think this group is doing okay. Yes, Jim's point about, you know, is this really automation and what other factors are at play, I think is really well taken. You know, one other example, I mean, his point was right on, but another example I could throw in, is this due to automation or globalization, or how do we really distinguish all these macro factors that are playing in? I don't in this paper, except, you know, looking at routine occupations as those that are most vulnerable to automation, but there's a million other things going on, and I think the point is very right. Breaking out into sectors or industries, I think it's a really good idea. One challenge in this particular data set is that there aren't very good industry codes, sector-level codes that we can use. And other sources of data, the CPS, et cetera, those are there, and we could test some of these ideas in a different way, but just not in the PSID, which I'm using in this particular study. I also think the idea of narrowing in on the recessions and seeing what happens during those time periods is particularly important. I know Henry and others have done work on this and find that it does matter when you look at those particular time periods. I have no smart thoughts on whether GM should have closed its plant, etc. All I will say about GM right now is that we saw a brief return in workers exercising their ability to strike, and that was something quite interesting. If you look at trends and strikes in this country, you know that from the 80s onwards, it's been incredibly low. But again, we can look cross-nationally and see the power of organized labor coming together and expressing their concern. If you look to Finland in the last 2 weeks, if you look to France right now, regardless of whether you agree with their perspectives, you have to admit they're pretty successful at letting their displeasure be known. Strikes are important. Negative effects on companies. Agree, it's really important to test. I can't do it in this data. And dynamics, longer-term effects, a really important point, and I'll give that more thought in the future.
Sarah, you have anything to add or comment on?
I think that you covered it really well. I'll just add one thing to the question of, you know, this movement into non-routine cognitive skills. Like, I think, you know, one question that's hard to get at here is what's the value of the stability? You know, so obviously, you know, mobility, upward mobility might be good, but then, you know, these jobs may be less stable or, so I think, you know, we're seeing part of what we're seeing here is that the union jobs are more stable, but I think maybe you could look at that more directly. Like, I don't know if the PSID has job tenure, so you could see whether people are staying in the same jobs. I think that there could be, there could be selection happening that explains that finding. So I would encourage like pushing on a little bit more to make sure that it's not just that kind of people who enter non-routine unionized jobs. Those are just like different jobs with different paths than the union ones. I mean, to a certain extent, if that's true and they really have the same skill content, that's, you know, getting at what you're getting at. But I think, you know, unpacking that a little bit. And, you know, one of the most striking things is in the paper is from the individual fixed effects analysis where you see when people transition into unionized status, which, you know, which he refers to as joining a union, but it could be, and I suspect often is associated with a job change. And we had a conversation offline that it, the ability to see what that change, to see inside that job change might be limited in the PSID. But I think, you know, to the extent you can say something about that and maybe in other data, like understanding what those transitions look like might shed light on, you know, sort of where some of these effects are coming from. Because there's this huge immediate decline in the probability of becoming unemployed when people transition into unionized, you know, become unionized, but that could be changing jobs. And so I think it's very big and it's very immediate. So I think it's, to unpack that a little more might shed some light on that.
Once again, Sarah anticipated my next question. So I wanted you to talk about that issue, and she kind of laid it out, this issue of treating, you know, joining a union as an absorbing state, right? And I'm really worried about the idea, because there could be job changes, there could be law changes, right, in the geography wherever they live. And so part of the reason why you might get variation in union membership is just because of sort of environmental changes or job changes, not necessarily something about their active choice. And so I wanted you to push on that a little bit more. So any additional questions?
Yes. I just want to address the question about the AFL-CIO. If you think they don't have the evidence-based policy, are you comparing it to the Chamber of Commerce or the National Association of Manufacturing? And if you want to know whether unions have an adverse effect on employment or firms, then there is a lot of research on that. You want to look into it. And I would suggest that maybe you contact Bill Spriggs, the chief economist at the AFL-CIO, who recently was the chair of the economics department at Howard University, and he'd be glad to provide you with that. Alternatively, if you come from Germany, you might look at the evidence on co-determination, and I think all the evidence on co-determination is that there's a very positive impact on firms. So I think your condescension is very misplaced.
I don't know if you caught that I said I was devil's advocate in this case. But so I wasn't actually suggesting this.
Yes, sir.
There you go. I'm surprised right-to-work states haven't played into this conversation yet. I mean, it's a big deal, right? I mean, if sometimes you just don't have the opportunity to join a union because they're not promoted.
That's essentially what I was getting at.
Oh, okay.
About the question about the environment changing.
Yeah, right.
Okay. Not necessarily choice changes. Martin, did you have a question? Yes, sir.
I had a follow-up example. I wanted to clarify what concerns me. The education group of Brookings, one of the cases they were presenting a couple of months ago was on Bangladesh women's garment workers. Mm-hmm. Now, if you know Bangladesh, that is actually their main export sector, and it's the main sort of up-value thing for the whole of girl empowerment. But right now, the problem seems to be that the textile industry is going through a lot of technological change. So if all you did was try and protect the current workers' wages as opposed to upgrade their skills and give them more training, you will actually bankrupt the nation and bankrupt the women's empowerment in Bangladesh. So you have to be careful in terms of, you know, only arguing for protecting the wages. I am not clear that what is happening in France is actually going to be good for France, but then I don't know. But the case of Bangladesh, I do know what is desperately needed is more training so that they can stay in the smart part of the textile sector. And that's why I'm concerned for the second type of union, which actually requires the training to advance the worker into the new kind of sector.
So any last questions? Okay, well, thank you, Zach and Sarah, for great discussion, great paper. And now we'll have lunch, and we'll have our lunchtime speaker at 12:30.
No, 1:05.
Oh, 1:05, I'm sorry.
But on the dot, 1:05 on the dot.
Sorry about that.